Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about our governor, the son-in-law, busted with allegedly busted with a wad of marked bills. Our narcotics officer with a wad of marked bills from a drug sting. maybe even a freezer full. Who knows? And the last guy with a freezer full, we made him a representative. So, hey, maybe there's a future in this political game for Corbett's kid. We'll talk about that. Also, it's Super Choice Week. That's it. Actually, Public Education Destruction Week. We'll have choice for liquor on every corner, choice for the lottery and gambling everywhere, and, of course, more education cuts to come. This morning's headline blew me away. Schools might need liquor privatization. Might actually need that liquor to make sure our kids get an education. What in the world is wrong with us? Also, more voting news. Cumberland County commissioners back in the news. Another blatant attempt by the GOP majority to roadblock college students. We'll talk about that. Also, Harrisburg back in the news. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 sinkholes. We'll talk about why. And, of course, guns. More fun on the guns front. Also, your emails, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We are here in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA Healthcare Conference, our last day here. And, you know, yesterday I enjoyed some of the conversations we had. I hope you did, too. Some interesting emails back on that. You can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the big game, I don't know that I'm allowed to use the S word. Since it has been patented, I'm sure big game has been patented too. What the hell? The Super Bowl's this weekend. Do you really care? As someone who grew up in Cleveland, anybody but the Ravens is kind of my view on this, and I know I'll probably take some heat for it, but I don't care. You know, you look at the fact that, you know, this should have been the Browns. That simple. But, you know, again, it goes back to the greed. It goes back to the big moneyed interest. And it's angering and it's frustrating. But in case you're going to watch the big game, the National Chicken Council wants you to know that everything's going to be okay. The chicken wings will be there. Don't worry about it. The 1.23 billion wings that people will consume over this weekend, about four for everybody, they will be there. And thank goodness that they've told us this. And again, you know, I look at this as another one of those manufactured crises, because later on in the story, it talks about how, well, this year, you know, the price of the little wings are going to go up a little bit more. Because, of course, we created this crisis. Another one. And then, you know, this is, you know, one of those things that the National Chicken Council, I'm sure, is what they get paid for. Because, you know, hey, if you can jack the prices up, more profit, right? I remember, and it wasn't all that long ago, that the wings, they gave away. You go to the bar, and they were there like peanuts. Here, take them. They're free. We're going to take them before we throw them away. And now they're making huge, huge bank off of it. And thanks to the National Chicken Council. And I say we should run them for Congress. What do you think? Another created crisis. You know, look at the last several crises we've worked through, and I see yesterday the Senate approved the debt ceiling push-off, another one of those, or the grand fiscal mirage, if you will. And I still love the story put out by the Peterson Foundation that our debt is going towards 200% of GDP, even after we've dealt with the fiscal mirage. And I love the big headline, because, you know, everyone thinks we're going to be like Greece. And the other message is we can't afford to do the big things that need to be done. We can't fund education. We can't fund roads and bridges and infrastructure. We sure can't afford to fund health care because we're 200% in debt. Well, in 40 years, if everything stays the same, if we continue down the same path without any job growth, without any changes. At the end of the article, they point out where we really are. We're at 72% of GDP as our debt ratio. And nowhere near the 200. But it's all about that scare. It's all about the fear. It's all about going, whoa, 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 hey, you know, we can't afford to do those big things. But what we can do is we can give out more tax cuts. And I look at this guy in Montana who, you know, right out there in front, right out there blatant, not – you got to give them credit. They're honest. they're going to give a tax cut specifically for the top 1%. They're going to drop the highest income bracket down from 6.9 to 5.9. And, you know, I look at our governor. Why not? We're doing everything else that we can do to make sure that the well-heeled are better off. And while gutting education, while throwing low-wage workers off of adult basic, while throwing kids off the CHIP program, you know, all the things that our governor has done over the last 2 years and is going to continue to do the next two. Because, you know, the big story I saw, education funding is going to be flat. No, inflation continues to go up. If we're not keeping up with that, we're losing. It's actually a cut. Pretty simple stuff. Anyway, the job numbers are out today, 157,000 new jobs in January. But unemployment up 7.9, up from 7.8%. And again, you know, you go back to this, the jobs bills. You know, in our state, you know, we're talking about privatizing the liquor, privatizing the lottery. Still no infrastructure. Still no transportation bill. And maybe next week, maybe the governor in his State of the State address will bring up the fact that it's been 2 years. His commission had a wonderful little report that he's completely ignored. Some things in it I like, some things I don't. But actually building things and making that bridge that I cross over relatively safe so that I don't have to continue praying to get from one side to the other. I know that's what the Republicans want. 2012 was the year of the Bible after all. Maybe I'd like it a little more secure. And, you know, you look at this time, and we talked about the report from the Corporation for Enterprise Development that showed almost half the nation, almost half the country living on the edge of fiscal collapse because they don't have the savings to fall back on. And the recession, you know, I keep hearing, well, you know, we might fall back into recession. But for most people, we never left recession. For the vast majority of the people, we're actually still in a major recession. I still know people who 2 years looking for a job. I know people who haven't seen a raise in 5, 10 years. At the end of this, it's about creating jobs. And I look at the governor's plans. I look at most of the Republican plans. It's about selling off our state assets. It's about, well, it's about handing more to the people that they claim are the job creators, the Papa Johns of the world. And I still love the story that, you know, the numbers that Papa John came up with for his opposition to Obamacare, just made up. I just pull them out of thin air. Who knows where they were? Interesting, interesting stuff. Anyway, we are here in Washington, D.C., the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm going to be talking to folks all evening. So stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
America. Rick Smith. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
At the Families USA Health Conference in Washington, D.C., Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin told Workers Independent News that she believes President Obama is truly committed to a progressive agenda.
I think he's very serious about it and very much a president who, with the election behind him, is looking toward addressing real problems that we have in our country. We'll shortly hear the details of his propositions when he makes his State of the Union address, and I expect to hear continuation of the same themes that we saw at the inaugural.
Senator Baldwin supports worker rights to collectively bargain, and she says the rights taken from Wisconsin public workers should be restored.
The power to come together to speak collectively is incredibly important, and obviously in Wisconsin we've seen workers attacked for exercising just that basic right. I truly believe it needs to be restored, but we have a lot of battles to fight along those lines. including a recent lower court case questioning the actions of the Labor Relations Board.
As far as Senator Baldwin is concerned, cuts to Social Security and Medicare are off the fiscal negotiation table in Washington.
With regard to Medicare and Social Security, you know, when people have worked hard their whole lives, part of the dream of a middle class is to have a secure retirement. These should be off the table, I believe, in our discussions moving forward.
On gun control, Baldwin says she supports the Second Amendment but wants to see common sense changes to gun laws, including greater use of background checks for gun buyers. And she says the political dynamic really does seem to have changed and shifted in favor of comprehensive immigration reform.
I was very encouraged to see four Democratic senators and four Republican senators come out with an agreed-upon set of principles for comprehensive immigration reform. Now, this was not a bill. This was a set of principles. But I think that shows a recognition both that we need to do this because it's long overdue, but also a political understanding that the parties need to work together to get this done. So I'm very encouraged that we'll be able to make sincere and significant progress.
Senator Baldwin was the keynote speaker at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Lots of things thrown around about Obamacare, and I saw this quote yesterday from a state senator from Idaho, a Republican woman named Cheryl Nuxall. She said the insurance companies are creating their own tomb, much like the Jews boarding the trains to the concentration camps. Private insurers are used by the feds to put the system in place because the federal government has no way to set up the exchange. And you go, how extreme is your disdain and your dislike of the program when you're invoking the Holocaust? What exactly is wrong with some of these people? It's just mind-blowing in my estimation. And I guess it shows the lengths that some will go to tear it down and take just an opportunity for the uninsured folks to get some. It just blows my mind. Anyway, we're here in Washington, D.C., the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I've got Elaine Saley sitting across from me. She's a health policy analyst here at Families USA. Elaine, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You know, we hear an awful lot of that. I mean, just some of the most obnoxious, outrageous, insane statements like that one. And you go, how is this woman an elected official anywhere? I don't even want her being a dog catcher.
No, I mean, it's not that they're using the plans. The plans are an integral part of the exchange. Regulation of these plans and basic consumer protections that we've needed for so long is how these exchanges are going to work, to be able to, so that people can sign up for a plan regardless of their health status, so they can get care when they're sick, and so that they can afford the coverage that they're purchasing.
Yeah, I look at this, and, you know, while this woman from Idaho may be insane, her governor, who is also a Republican, has taken a position that I think Republicans should take. I mean, it's the law of the land, and especially the governors who, you know, like our governor has chosen not to. We're in Pennsylvania. He said, we're going to let the feds do it, which to me blows my mind. Why would you cede control to someone else? I'm glad he did. But there in Idaho, the governor, who was a Republican, said, you know what, we're going to set up our own exchange. We're not going to cede that power to anyone else. And to me, that seems logical.
Yeah, I mean, I think the federal government wants states to take as much responsibility as possible. They've really pushed and extended deadlines for states to run their own exchanges, and they've extended opportunities to partner with the federal government to implement these exchanges as well. But we expect that the federal exchanges, I mean, they are, of course, working with state plans. They're working with community-based organizations in every state to get the word out about the coverage and to help people to enroll in the coverage. So, you you know, regardless of how the exchange gets set up, and we're now calling them marketplaces, but regardless of how that gets set up, we are the state and community entities. It will be a state-specific effort. It needs to be. It has to be.
Right.
So.
You know, I look at this, and you know, I go back and I look at all the effort and all the energy and all the insanity that's gone into denying this and destroying it, and I just wish there was some that kind of energy, that kind of interest in making it work and getting people insured. I mean, whatever your view on it is, put that kind of energy into making sure that we don't have 50 million people uninsured and 100 million underinsured, because yeah, I don't know that that's good for society, not just for the individual, but for society when you have that many people on the edge of collapse. You know, the study, 43, for almost half the nation, you know, a paycheck or two away from poverty. I mean, it's insane. We can't, how can you run the most powerful country and the wealthiest country in the world like that?
Or a job loss away from you know, poverty and sickness that really can destroy someone's life. I mean, we get consumers who call us at Families USA, even though we're a policy organization, who tell us about that they lost their job and they lost their employer-based coverage and they weren't able to afford COBRA because, you know, Congress didn't renew the subsidies. And they're not able to get the care that they need to deal with a chronic condition, and they're not able to go back to work. I mean, it has a very profound economic impact, not just medical debt, but not having health insurance. So it definitely affects economies. It's way beyond a personal issue.
I mean, it's way too much insecurity for a society. I mean, because at the end of the day, you talk about someone who gets sick or loses a job, and now you've got all of the other things. The social safety net programs are going to be overtaxed. The foreclosures that happen, all of that insecurity.
Hospitals going bankrupt.
That kind of stuff. And you go, at some point, you do have to shore up the bottom. So for me, shoring up the bottom helps the top more than just as much.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, that's why we're encouraging states to expand Medicaid. It makes economic sense, and it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. You know, the coming months are, I think, the most important. And I've said this, you know, the reason I'm glad our governor has ceded control to the federal government, because I do believe whoever sets it up will set it up one way or another, and that could be beneficial or could be detrimental. And I think our governor, being one of the people who was against it from the beginning, would set up a plan that would be detrimental to the average person. So the coming months are going to be really crucial in how this whole thing is unrolled, it's laid out, and how folks are enrolling in the plan. Can you talk a little bit about what you see potentially happening over the next couple of months?
Yes. Well, over the next few months, the federal government is already setting up consumer assistance systems and exchanges where they will be contracting with community-based organizations who will be able to help get grants to help consumers to enroll in coverage. So they're looking for organizations, various types of entities. It could be nonprofits. It could be trade associations, chambers of commerce, who have connections with individuals and small businesses that will be eligible to enroll in coverage through the exchanges. And they will be setting up those programs in the next few months, providing training for those entities to help with enrollment. And then they're working on the website and the call center for the exchange. There's going to be a 24-hour-a-day call center where people can call to get help, to ask questions about the coverage, and to also enroll in the coverage. And, of course, open enrollment begins October 2013. You can start enrolling in plans, and the coverage begins on January 1st, 2014. So I would encourage people to go to healthcare.gov to learn about, the timeline for implementation, what coverage options will be available, and to approximate based on your income, you know, how much this type of coverage would cost you, whether you're eligible.
Yeah. Do you see? I see a whole lot of roadblocks and a whole lot of pitfalls along the way, and it's going to give people like this woman from Idaho an opportunity to take shots at it. Because I see this as something almost generational. I mean, it's something that's going to take years to roll out and years to perfect and implement. I guess the question then becomes: Are we ready to deal with those problems and then the messaging that comes with it?
I think you're absolutely right. Well, the first challenge is getting the word out that coverage is available. I mean, organizations that we work closely with have done studies that say that 78% of people who will be eligible for coverage don't know that the coverage is going to be available in about 8 months. I mean, it's less than a year away when people will be enrolling, and they don't know that it's available. So I think we have a huge public education challenge here, and then these consumer assistance resources will really be critical in making sure that people can easily enroll in coverage, and that they can find out about coverage from organizations and other kinds of groups in the state that they trust and that they get information and services from now.
Now, you see the same polling when you talk about food stamps and other social programs. Most people don't know that they're eligible for them, but do you think the health care will be a little bit easier than the other programs in that if you end up having to go to the hospital, there would be someone with an interest to make sure that you have some coverage so they get compensated?
Yeah, that's part of it. Enrollment through providers is definitely a very, very important strategy that I think every state should be looking at, and we know that a lot of them are.
Because I know a lot of the hospitals are saying, you know, we want these states to take the Medicaid expansion money because, you know, that's how we're going to survive. And at some point you have to go, there's some self-interest in it for them to make sure that everyone is covered as well.
Right, and Medicaid is a huge part of that. I think that, since everyone will be using the same application, I think this may be somewhat easier because the coverage provided through exchanges is private coverage, so it's just like signing up for a health plan today. So it's a little bit more accessible, I think. You know, people are familiar with the concept of getting an insurance plan, but many don't because they.
I would say the people who don't have it are the folks who probably can't do those or have never done them.
Right, are unfamiliar with how to sign up, don't know what the terms are, don't know what the benefits are, think that it will be too expensive. Oftentimes it is now too expensive to buy. So making all of that information more accessible is, I think, going to help people to take advantage of private insurance and public insurance opportunities and using one form to determine what programs you're eligible, how much financial assistance you can get. It makes it so much easier, I think, for families.
Now, but I look at this and I go, how many, I know a number of folks who are uninsured and, they're not going to be able to read. I have a hard time reading. I have an impossible time reading my health care and my health insurance or my life insurance or any of these things that are written by teams of lawyers with the intent of making sure you don't understand what it is. Is there anything in this where the average everyday guy or woman is going to look at this and go, okay, I understand it?
Yes, actually, already there's a form that started to be circulated in September that was just issued. It's a new health insurance disclosure, and it's called the Summary of Benefits and Coverage. And if you're in the individual market, it's available to you now. It's a plain language summary of your benefits and your cost on your plan. It's required to be provided when you're shopping for coverage and when you're enrolling. So people actually have that information before they enroll in a plan rather than buying a plan based on advertising documents and then enrolling in the plan and having to wade through, as you were saying, a policy that includes tons of legal language and fine print, oftentimes people are getting that and wading through it when they've already been denied, coverage for a service. So it's a huge problem. It's definitely something that was directly addressed in the healthcare law. So if you're in the individual insurance market, you should request your summary benefits and coverage. If you are in an employer-based plan, when your open enrollment begins, you should request your summary of benefits and coverage.
Yeah, I look at this, though, and there's part of me that goes, why do I need a marketplace? Why can't we just say, you're covered? If you get sick, you're not going to go bankrupt. If you get sick, you're not going to lose everything that you've had. And why do we have to have this shopping? It makes no sense to me. Either you're covered or you're not. Either, the cancer is going to be treated or it's not. This whole shopping thing is kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah, well, we're building off the system we have now. We have a private insurance system where, companies compete. And I think, we're leveraging some of the advantages of that system, which are, better consumer information and understanding of your choices, helps competition to raise the quality, the level of the quality in plans, and to make sure that the best plans are getting the biggest share of consumers. So I think we're leveraging, the strengths of the market we have now, and that's why this law really does build off of what we already have, and so it's.
And hopefully as we move forward, much like Medicare, we will strengthen and improve it. Elaine Saley, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much, Health Policy Analyst, Families USA. Quick break, right back after this from Washington, D.C. and the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Back after this.
Con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
I'm told that many Americans long to return to the idyllic days of yesteryear, to the small-town wholesomeness of the 1950s, when everyone valued freedom, truth, church, community, baseball, and Walt Disney. Never mind that such a fantastic time and place didn't actually exist. The important thing is that there is someone today, a unique visionary, who plans to build just such a utopia for all who yearn to have a life of harmony and happiness. Glenn Beck. Yes, the walking, talking ego of the far, far, far out right. Beck has built his lucrative career on fostering fear, disparaging whole segments of our society, promoting plutocratic elitism, and spreading divisive lies and conspiracy theories. But lately, he's been humming Kumbaya and offering himself as the recreator and guru of the elusive yesteryear. In early January, he revealed that his dream is to build a place that is some hybrid of a small town, a theme park, an entrepreneurial incubator, a re-education center to instill right-wing truth in young people, and, in his words, a retreat from the world. He wants to call it Independence, USA. It will have everything, a residential area where rich and poor will live as neighbors, a marketplace with real businesses and stores, a media center for himself and others, including a school, quote, where aspiring journalists would learn to be great reporters, a ranch where residents will grow food and where visitors can learn how to farm, a theme park, possibly based on Ayn Rand's creators versus moochers dichotomy, and a church that, oddly, would be, quote, modeled after the Alamo. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a place! Of course, the downside to living in Glenn's dream world is that he'd be there, too. That'd definitely spoil the perfection.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Since the investor class, diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So this has really been the year of the sinkhole. I mean, 41 sinkholes in the city of Harrisburg in the last year alone, the last couple. You know, I joke with folks, you know, hey, I'm not so much worried about the crime of the city as I'm worried about being sucked up by a sinkhole, because really we have not. And it comes back to our governor, it comes back to past governors, it comes back down to this, well, you think about it, 30 years of handing tax dollars to the very wealthy, handing tax dollars to these big corporations who then suck the resource out of the country, investing elsewhere. What do you expect? You've got an infrastructure that's 120 years old, just like the water and sewer lines that go under the streets of Harrisburg. So it's no wonder that we're losing water, that the water that we're supposed to be moving from one place to another through the sewer system, getting backed up, leaking under the streets, and eroding the ground away underneath the streets. It's really no surprise. And for me, I've been saying all throughout this recession that what we need to be doing is we need to be going back and upgrading all of this infrastructure, you know, much like FDR did during the Depression. Get people back to work, rebuilding our infrastructure. Get people back to work, building the future of infrastructure. And, you know, I love the line. I'm not a big fan of Thomas Friedman, but I love the line because it's accurate. You know, you go from Beijing to LAX, it's like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. And you're not going to continue to be a superpower in this globe, this global economy, if you're the Flintstones. It is that simple. And what I've been saying for years is, and you're pointing to several areas just around the country where there's tension about water supplies, is that water is going to be the next resource that we fight over. Oil, will probably be a thing of the past. It's going to be water, because you can live without oil. We can find an alternative. Rex Tillerson is right. The CEO of ExxonMobil, he's right when he says, look, we can engineer our way out of these things. Out of some things we can engineer our way out of. Water, I don't know that water is one of those things we can engineer our bodies to be without. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's something I've missed. Maybe there was a biology class or something I missed that said, hey, we can use something else besides water. Considering, well, I guess like 70% of our bodies are water. Without it, we die. Pretty simple. You can go 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 days without eating. Good luck trying to go 10 days without drinking any water. Not going to happen. And what we're doing is what we're seeing under not just the Harrisburg area, but, you know, all across this country is we're seeing aging infrastructure, pipes that are 100, 120 years old that are leaking, that are eroding away underneath the streets, ticking bombs waiting to happen. And as I said, I think we're going to be fighting wars at some point over the next couple of decades. And I look at this report by the United Nations, who says that currently 41% of the world's population lives in areas where the water supply is already stressed to the maximum. And you're seeing what I'm saying. They're going to start fighting over this resource. And another report that just came out said, look, some 1.7 trillion gallons of water, 1.7 trillion gallons of water each and every year leaks from those 120-year-old pipes. And, of course, it's going to erode away the soil around the pipes. It's going to cause sinkholes. It's going to cause major problems. But it's a precious resource. And, you know, at the rate that we pollute it, at the rate that we waste it, and I look at the drilling, you know, how much water does it take to go and get that gas out of the ground? The fracking process takes millions and millions of gallons of water that are just polluted, and good luck, it's gone. Well, now what you're seeing is you're seeing IBM, who I guess has partnered up with this water fund group to create the first ever water cost index. And you go, what exactly is a water cost index? Well, they want to bring in global investors. They have used big data analysis, and according to the daily ticker, it will estimate the cost of producing water globally for 25% of the world's GDP. And they say it will allow the creation of financial products to invest in the water sector. It's a water sector now. Water is now an industry. When I was a kid, you could go get a drink at a drinking fountain. Good luck finding a drinking fountain today. Everything's bottled water. It's now a commodity that big money. When you've got Coke as the largest, one of the largest water suppliers in the country and in the world, there's a problem because it all comes in a nice plastic bottle. And you know, I remember a number of years ago I saw a movie called The Take. And it was a couple of things that caught my attention. One of them was this, the whole use of the IMF, where the IMF says, you know, you owe money, your economy can't pay it back, you're in too far in debt, so you've got to go privatize all of your assets. You've got to privatize your sewer and your water and your electric companies and your education and your health care. And the list goes on, your social safety net, your public welfare, your pension. You've got to privatize all of that. And this one film that I saw was on Bolivia, where Bechtel had gone in and bought the water supply, and I believe it was Bolivia, and how over a couple year span, the cost of getting water had jumped like 300%. In fact, you couldn't put a bucket of water outside, a bucket to collect water outside, because now water falling from the sky was owned by Bechtel. And they had the rights to it. And it was really just, for me, it was a cautionary tale. It's one of these things that, you know, we haven't done it yet. We still look at water in this country as part of the commons. We have public sewer. We have public water lines. A lot of people have, like in my house, I've got a well. At some point, what it looks to me is we're going to make water just another commodity that's speculated, that's bought, that's sold, that's traded. And your right to it, gone. The fact that you need it to survive, not important. It will be your ability to pay, much like we've done with healthcare, much like we're doing with education, much like we've done with a lot of things. There's this commodification of certain things that used to be owned by you, me, we, the people, now not so much. And one of the guys who is working on this group, a guy named Peter Williams. He's an IBM distinguished engineer, and he's big green innovation CTO. He says there's plenty of capital that's beginning to take interest in investing in water. And I go, of course they're going to. It's when we make air a commodity, there's going to be plenty of money investing in air, because you know what? You need it. And if you need it and you're thirsty enough, and you're that close, you're going to pay for it. And how much are you going to pay? Whatever they're asking. Just like we do with pharmaceuticals. Whatever the pharmaceutical company asks, that's what we pay. There's no negotiation. There's no fighting. You need it. You're going to pay for it. If you don't, sorry, you're a dead man. And he says what we think the index will do is it'll make it easier to invest in water by establishing a risk benchmark. A risk benchmark for water. You know what the risk of making water a commodity is? You die. He goes on to say the idea then is to encourage capital inflows into the water sector. It's no longer about being part of the commons. It's no longer about being a necessity for human consumption, for human survival. No, it is now a commodity. It is now something. It's now part of a sector where there's going to be profit and massive profit attached to it. And not for you and not for me and not for our children, but for a handful of global investors. The article goes on to say that, you know, and this is one of those things that you kind of, as I've been saying, they point out the one risk. There's a risk. The misadventures of the mortgage-backed securities during the housing crisis, not to mention the commodities bubbles and the tech stuff and all that, they say may raise eyebrows when it comes to the idea of speculation over an element so essential to life. And, you know, again, this is one of those things that I don't know how you can lose if you invest in it. I think it's impossible, because you hold on to it long enough, someone's going to need it. And one of the guys quoted in the article, and again, you know, these are people who know what they're doing. They know what they're talking about. They know where the money is. A guy named Scott Rickards, he's the president and CEO of Water Fund. He says it's taken 25 years for the housing to go from non-financed to where we are today with after everything that's occurred 4 years ago. He says when it comes to water, if it ever gets where their speculation is a problem, he says that will not be a bad thing because we will have come a long way in the meantime. Not quite sure what that means. If it becomes a problem, I'm telling you it's going to be a problem right from the beginning. Look what's happened with oil. Look at how the speculators have really jumped the price of a barrel of oil and thus a gallon of gas. I read something not too long ago. A barrel of oil traded 27 times just in transit. Nobody ever took control of it. Nobody ever owned it. It was just bought and sold while it's still being shipped here. What makes you think water is not going to be the same thing? And, well, if it happens, it won't be a bad thing. Of course it won't be a bad thing for people like him because he's going to be the one benefiting from it. And, you know, I think back to, you know, my wife and I had looked at we were going to buy some land up in the northeast part of Pennsylvania. And I remember at the time that one of the sticking points of the property that we were looking at buying was that there was a little brook that ran through the property. And my wife just said, wow, this is fantastic. We have to get it because this is here. And the real estate agent said, whoa, hold on. Hold on, we got a problem. Houston, there is a problem. Turns out, 100 years ago, this hunting and this fishing club bought the water rights to this brook. So as the owner of the property, I would not be allowed, under any circumstances, to even put my feet in the water, let alone pull any water out of it, to drink anything out of it, and heaven forbid something were to leak into it. Then you would be, like some people like Chicago, for instance, for St. Patrick's Day, they dye the river there, or the lake there, they dye part of it green. If you were to do that, it would be almost a federal case, because now you have a private interest that owns the water, not just the property, but the water. And I look at this and I go, you know, and I said at the time, we're walking away from it, don't want any part of it. This is a bad deal. No matter what it is you do, we got to get away from it. And I'm glad we did because from people we know who ended up with the property, it is a nightmare dealing with the people who own this because, look, it's their commodity. And, you know, good luck if you want any part of it. So as I look at this and I go down the line and I think about this water system, and we're going to be told that we need to privatize our water and sewer, and we need to, because you've got these forces that are saying, hey, sell off all the state assets. You don't need them. We need the cash now. It's like the guy on TV. Do you need cash now? Well, this is what we're doing. Cash now. We're going to be the liquor and lottery state. And well, of course, no natural resources, no commodity of our own, no commons, no we the people. And water, to me, one of those things that without it, you die. So why would we, again, you know, think about this for a second. You know, this is something that we invested in, and we're gonna pay for it again. You know, I love this idea, well, we'll privatize it, let the private capital take care of it. And you go, well, maybe on the short term, they're going to be the ones who invest in it, but who's going to pay for it? Obviously, you and I are going to pay for it through considerably higher rates, through much higher payments for our water bill. Instead of doing it for ourselves and spreading it out over 100 years or however, I mean, we've got 120 years out of the sewer pipes and the sewer lines and the water lines there in Harrisburg. It's time for them to be dug up, replaced. And you know what? Let's do that for the people 100 years from now. Considering we should have a little bit better technology than they did 120 years ago. Maybe a little bit better monitoring, maybe a little bit better quality construction. Just maybe. I'm not betting on that because, you know, the way things have gone, the materials that we use today don't seem to last like they used to. And I've heard that argument from the old timers for many years. That, well, they just don't build things like they used to. And maybe they're right. Because I still see bridges that were built back into the Depression that are still in workable condition, that are still structurally sound. But, you know, I see bridges built 20, 30, 40 years ago. Those are the ones that are struggling. Those are the ones that are deficient. So you got, there's part of me goes, well, we got to look into that as well. But to me, it's about the jobs. I mean, how many jobs do you think you would create just in Harrisburg alone? To go street by street, block by block, area by area, replace those pipes, upgrade, and, oh, by the way, save all of that water that we're now losing through leakage. And nationwide, 1.7 trillion gallons of water just gone in leakage. And, you know, I go back to when Jerry Brown ran for the Democratic nomination, back years and years ago. I think it was 1988. He said that his plan was to train electricians, enough electricians, to rewire every house in America, to rewire every line, to rewire every outlet box, to rewire the whole nation. Because if, and this is one of those numbers you go, wow, where'd that come from? But something like 60% of all of the electricity that we produce is lost in transmission. So you think about that. You think about the $1.7 trillion in water, 1.7 trillion gallons of water. You think about 60% of the electricity. You think of all of this stuff in transition. Why? That we're losing? Why? Well, obviously, poor infrastructure. So wouldn't you go, hey, we should be investing in infrastructure because, hey, we can save stuff. We can save this resource. It makes perfect sense to me. And I think it makes perfect sense to the average everyday working Joe and Jane like me who we're the ones paying the bills. And I'll be honest, I don't want to be paying it to Bechtel. I don't want to be paying it to one of these big multinational corporations who could care less about humanity, society, our community. They care about the bottom line. Pure and simple, nothing more, nothing less, how much coin is going into their pocket. That's it. Bottom line. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
In late 2012, a planet was found in the Alpha Centauri star system, only 4.3 light years from Earth.
It's the nearest extrasolar planet found yet, but getting there would be hard. If you imagine Earth as a grain of sand, then Alpha Centauri would be over 10 kilometers, or about 6 miles, away.
So how could we get to Alpha Centauri? A vehicle like the space shuttle couldn't do it. If Earth were the size of a sand grain, the shuttle's orbit would be about the width of a hair, in contrast to the 10 kilometers to Alpha Centauri.
How about the two Voyager spacecraft, launched in 1977? They're now heading out of the solar system. They're not aimed towards Alpha Centauri, but if they were, it would take tens of thousands of years to get there. Meanwhile, other propulsion systems, for example, antimatter engines and solar sails, haven't advanced far enough for star travel.
And here's the real problem with traveling to Alpha Centauri. Suppose we chose a method of travel and set out for a trip among the stars. Suppose that, generations from now, our descendants arrived at a planet in the Alpha Centauri system. They might be greeted by a brass band and crowds of Earthlings who left later but traveled by a more efficient process, and so made the trip in a shorter time. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the word Starship. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
When we did the Supreme Court...
Guess what? The majority of the American people believe we should have a gold standard, not a paper standard.
Big fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Big fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. We're here in Washington for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. The question that becomes, you know, as this unrolls, as more people become aware... How do we make sure that everyone who is eligible gets signed up? How do we make sure that we get everyone insured? Because I'm a firm believer of once everyone's insured, the costs will go down because maybe we'll start using healthcare in a little smarter way. Maybe we won't use the ER as our family doctor. Just a thought. I've got Jenny Sullivan here. She's the director of the Best Practices Institute for Enroll America. Jenny, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, absolutely.
The Best Practices Institute. Explain that.
Sure. So part of Enroll America's mission, or really the substance of our work, is a real big public education campaign to make sure as many people as possible who are going to be eligible for these new coverage options coming this year know about them. But once they know about them and they seek out coverage, we want to make sure that when they get to the front door of coverage, it's consumer-friendly, it's easy to navigate, it doesn't feel like a big, ugly, bureaucratic mess. And that's where the Best Practices Institute comes in.
But, yeah, I guess that would have to be very difficult considering you're going to have, theoretically, 50 individual states having 50 individual state exchanges. And, unfortunately, Pennsylvania is not going to have a state-based exchange. Our governor has ceded control to the feds, which I'm happy about because I fear what he would set up, which I want to ask you about as well. But, you know, it's got to be a difficult implementation if you're talking about all those different exchanges.
It is. I mean, we are going to have different looking systems in every state, but the Affordable Care Act gives us a set of principles for states to abide by as they create these systems, and it really brings us into the future, maybe even into the present day would be a good place to start in terms of how you apply for public benefits. There is a concept in the Affordable Care Act known as no wrong door that's really at the heart of all of this, that idea being, yes, there's a patchwork of coverage. Yes, there are lots of agencies that are working together to provide coverage to different folks depending on what bucket you're in, but the consumer does not need to be troubled with all of those rules. They should be able to seek out coverage through whichever door they find their way to first, and from that point on, the consumer is enrolled in the coverage for which they're eligible, and everyone in their household, in fact, should get connected to the coverage they need through that no wrong door.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of emphasis on these are private plans, and we're stuck on the private thing, and a whole bunch of private insurers are gonna. I heard it described as travelocity for health insurance, where you're gonna have all these different choices. And there's part of me that goes, do we really need all those choices? Yeah, shouldn't we just be covered?
I think, you know, the law is what it is in terms of the leeway it gives states and the federal government to provide a lot of options to people. But we recognize that is going to be really overwhelming for folks. And that's where, again, with best practices, it becomes very important that we set up those choices in a way that's user-tested, consumer-friendly, that makes sense, and that there's help for people. We found in our research that the majority of folks, once they learn that there's new coverage coming, say, yes, I'm interested in that coverage, but no, I don't think I can do it alone. I want someone who knows about this to help me through the process.
So walk me through this. Let's say because I know several people who have been uninsured for years, and, you know, they're looking forward to 2014. They're looking forward to, you know, hey, this is going to be a chance for me to have that security, that path to the middle class, because I'm a firm believer you can't be in the middle class without health security. So walk me through how is this going to look? Am I going to have to do website stuff? Is there going to be something at the post office? Mm-hmm. Walk me through this.
Well, the system is fortunately designed in a way that people will be able to enroll in whatever way they feels comfortable. If you're web savvy, you want to hop online and do it all yourself on your own time, that option will be available to everybody in every state. If, however, that makes you a little bit tentative, a little bit cautious, and you'd rather have somebody who knows what they're talking about, who's been trained to do this work, walk you through the process, you can do that as well. There will be what's called navigators in every state, as well as other kinds of assister programs in many states, so that there is trained, knowledgeable staff who don't have a bent for one particular plan or another that can provide unbiased information and help folks navigate that process.
Yeah, I'm kind of an analog person. I like paper.
Paper is an option as well, as is a telephone application. All three of those mediums, but with and without help, will be available to everybody
now,
in every state.
Let's say someone's not a telephone person, or they're not the paper person, they're not a web person. Is there like a face-to-face interface at some point down the road where maybe we go to an office? Because I know, like, my grandparents' generation, they're not web-savvy whatsoever. They hate the telephone, and they don't like paper either.
Absolutely. And I think the decisions about where those conversations will take place vary by state, but the notion is definitely that people will be able to have that in-person contact and have a navigator or another kind of assister, if you will, walk them through the process.
It's not going to be me calling a phone number, press 1 for this, press 2, because nothing drives me crazier than that. I'm being very serious, because a lot of people get frustrated with that whole process. Now we've automated, it's frustrating to me. I hang up on that stuff.
No, and I think that, you know, the allusions to Travelocity or Kayak are maybe nice, simple analogies to get the conversation started. But when we talk about purchasing health insurance, nobody in any of the focus groups we had any trouble distinguishing the fact that purchasing health insurance is really different than buying a car or shoes or a new vacation. Like, that is a fundamentally different process, and they want trusted sources providing reliable information about how to do this right.
So while you're doing these focus testing groups, what information to get out of them?
Well, I will not expand greatly on those, because that's really our public education director's bailiwick. But I will say that on the whole, people don't know what's coming. Once we tell them what's coming.
How can they not know it's coming? I mean, this has been, everyone's saying 2014, all the good stuff's going to come in 2014, just hang on. And part of my problem with the whole Affordable Care Act is that we had to wait till 2014.
Yeah, no.
So how can you not know?
I think, you know, we haven't had any concerted efforts to really deliver this information using messages and messengers that make sense, and that's exactly what Enroll America is trying to catalyze. But we want to get folks to the point where they understand what their options are, that they feel compelled to enroll or to seek out what they might be eligible for. And we have learned from our focus groups what I mentioned earlier, which is that people need help. So there can't be enough boots on the ground to provide really good assistance.
And as the director of the Best Practices Institute, I'm sure you will find the best ways to the most simplistic ways to get there.
We certainly hope so, yes.
Because this is a work in progress. I mean, there's really no blueprint for this yet.
No. I mean, that's exactly the purpose of the Best Practices Institute, is to recognize that just because a certain state is further along in the process of implementation doesn't mean they're doing everything right. And we really need to be casting a wide net and finding what's working well in different situations and then disseminating that as broadly as we can.
Yeah, because I wonder how much is being done in Pennsylvania at this point since nothing's been done. Our governor was one of the ones, the original, that signed on to the lawsuit against it. He has, said that he's not going to do anything with it. They're fighting back against the Medicaid expansion. So I wonder, the uninsured in our state, 41,000 when he took office, he booted off the adult basic, the minimal health insurance plan. And I guess that's the other question I've got for you. And looking at these plans, I look at when the governor took office just 2 years ago, kicking 41,000 low-wage workers. I mean, these aren't people who are collecting welfare, the folks who we say they're lazy and shiftless and all that other stuff. These are people who work with this minimal, extraordinarily minimal coverage, 4 appointments a year, just minimal stuff, booted them to the curb. My fear is that some of the plans that will be offered in our choice will be those kind of plans.
Well, and I think what is likely Pennsylvania's fate is that it will have a federally facilitated marketplace, I guess the word that we're using for it these days. And so I hope that, I know that the federal government is taking a lot of steps to make sure that the application process is working well and that they are coordinating with the Medicaid and CHIP agencies in Pennsylvania.
I like that. What we're using these days is beautiful. Jenny, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely.
Jenny
pleasure.
Sullivan, director of the Best Practices Institute for Enroll America. We've got a link to their website at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Jenny's name and take you right there. Quick break back here from Washington, D.C. Stick around.
You're listening to The Rick Smith
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
At the Families USA Health Conference in Washington, D.C., Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin told Workers Independent News that she believes President Obama is truly committed to a progressive agenda.
I think he's very serious about it and very much a president who, with the election behind him, is looking toward addressing real problems that we have in our country. We'll shortly hear the details of his propositions when he makes his State of the Union address, and I expect to hear continuation of the same themes that we saw at the inaugural.
Senator Baldwin supports worker rights to collectively bargain, and she says the rights taken from Wisconsin public workers should be restored.
The power to come together to speak collectively is incredibly important, and obviously in Wisconsin we've seen workers attacked for exercising just that basic right. I truly believe it needs to be restored, but we have a lot of battles to fight along those lines, including a recent lower court case questioning the actions of the Labor Relations Board.
As far as Senator Baldwin is concerned, cuts to Social Security and Medicare are off the fiscal negotiation table in Washington.
With regard to Medicare and Social Security, you know, when people have worked hard their whole lives, part of the dream of the middle class is to have a secure retirement. These should be off the table, I believe, in our discussions moving forward.
On gun control, Baldwin says she supports the Second Amendment but wants to see common sense changes to gun laws, including greater use of background checks for gun buyers. And she says the political dynamic really does seem to have changed and shifted in favor of comprehensive immigration reform.
I was very encouraged to see four Democratic senators and four Republican senators come out with an agreed-upon set of principles for a comprehensive immigration reform. Now, this was not a bill. This was a set of principles. But I think that shows a recognition both that we need to do this because it's long overdue, but also a political understanding that the parties need to work together to get this done. So I'm very encouraged that we'll be able to make sincere and significant progress.
Senator Baldwin was the keynote speaker at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for...
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We are here in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. In case you're just joining us, we've been here the last 2 days. The conference has run Thursday, Friday, and into Saturday. Healthcare people from around the country coming together to talk about how do we get the healthcare implemented? How do we now go from just the conceptual that we passed the law and went through the whole Supreme Court challenge? We've done all of that. Now it's time to getting it. Well, getting the nuts and bolts put together, getting everything, the wheels moving, and getting people actually insured. And I know there's a lot of things that have already gone into place. There's a lot of things. The rescission is gone. For some, pre-existing conditions are gone. For people under 26, they're getting insurance through their parents' plans. A lot of good things to begin with. One of the knocks that I've had about it, and, to be honest, in talking to some of the folks here, I did understand that, 2014 was probably the earliest you could get this kind of a major program, this kind of a major overhaul put into place. Personally, and I've said this before, I would have just assumed we open up Medicare, affix a price to it, let me buy it. And some subsidies for folks who can't afford it. To me, that seems logical. To me, that seems the right way to go. But, you know, this is the way we've chosen. Because, you know, as a couple of guests yesterday pointed out, it is who we are as a nation. Look, there's a good, healthy skepticism of government, and I'm with most people on that. But there is a level of skepticism that's healthy and constructive, and then there's just the outright insanity. That insanity that you see from the right wing that's willing to basically pursue scorched earth policy that would destroy our nation, and, you know, anyone's hope of getting health care along with it. But, you know, last night, while the cocktail parties were going on last night, while people were rubbing elbows and talking about war stories and the people that they had met on the trail, and I was struck by the number of folks that, you know, they talked about, and with just huge numbers. You know, when I did the Hungry and Homeless for the Holidays food drive a couple years back, and I've done a couple of them, but it was right after, you know, the Obamacare was passed, and they had these high-risk pools that were set up. I met several people who were able to get insurance and able to have their lives saved because they were able to get insurance, because before they were uninsurable. And I met a couple of people who said, look, you know, at the end of it, without these high-risk pools, without this ability to have some recourse to the insurance company saying, no, we're not going to cover you at any cost, my life's been saved. And I still remember the people who came out. It was like 2:00 in the morning. They came out to the site where we were spending the week in the parking lot, and said, look, you know, they knew I had a tumor, and they refused to cover me. I lost my job. I couldn't afford COBRA. I couldn't afford anything. And, you know, it was nothing, but I still want to work. And, you know, he was a small business owner, wasn't going to go on Medicaid, wasn't going to lose everything that he owns, ends up bankrupt. So he was able to get onto one of into this high-risk pool and got care. They went in, they took the tumor out. Turns out he had cancer. They went, they treated that. You know, real long story, very short, without the insurance, he dies. And he says, you know, I always believed, like many have said, well, we've got national insurance. You're sick, you just go to the doctor. And he's like, that's not absolutely the truth. And I've been saying for years, yeah, I mean, you can get care. You're not going to die immediately. And Mitt Romney was right. We're not going to let people die in their homes without an ambulance coming get them to take them to the hospital. And he's right. But they're going to come, they're going to pick you up, they're going to stabilize you, and we say, oh, you don't have insurance? And then they're going to do just enough to keep you alive to move you out the door. And then the ambulance company and the hospital and the ER and the doctors and everybody else are going to hound you to the day inevitably you die. Is that what we need? So last night, I talked to a whole bunch of people. One woman who said, look, you know, I've got diabetes. It's a hereditary thing. My parents had it. Their parents had it. Her kids now have juvenile diabetes. And she's like, look, you know, I've got to make this trade-off. I've got to make tough choices. You want to talk about choices? You want to talk about tough choices? The choice is, do I get my testing supplies or do I feed my kids? Do I get my testing supplies or do I pay for my basic necessities? Do I keep a roof over my head? And for me, this idea that people don't have the basic testing supplies as a matter of course is mind-blowing. Because for me, it goes back to that whole prevention thing. If you've already got diabetes, there's no preventing getting that, but it's preventing it from getting worse. Preventing you from having any of the, you know, the going blind, the kidney failure, all of the things that go along with it, the amputations. You know, the number of amputations that go on in this country every year because of diabetes, the tens of thousands, 95% of them are paid by Medicare. And you go, what kind of incentive is it for the insurance companies to say, okay, we'll cover testing supplies, when they know at the end of the road, you can't work, you're no longer in the private insurance pool because Medicare is going to pick it up. And this is where I do agree with conservatives on some things, that having government back things is where the abuse ends up. You get these private for-profit corporations who go, well, we'll just deny it. We'll just push it down the road. We'll kick the can down the road, and it'll be on the backs of the taxpayers. And this is why I've said it all along. We need stronger regulations, and we need, well, We need to either impose some basic minimums or we need to take it over and run it for ourselves. And as I've been talking to people, you know, there are some basic minimums in this plan and testing supplies and prevention. To me, one of the big keys in any healthcare system are in them. So the hope is this, you know, this woman I met, she'll be able to get the supplies she needs so that she can test her blood 2, 3, 4 times, however times she needs to a day to make sure that she doesn't run too high or too low. And that we don't have all the expense that comes along with, just from purely an economic standpoint. You know, she runs a low blood sugar, she passes out, what do? They call an ambulance. Ambulance comes, takes her away, drives her to the hospital, you go through the ER, they give her some orange juice, she's fine. You've just spent over $1,000 in healthcare spending for what? Because they weren't able to test her sugar. It makes no sense to me. And yeah, you know, I met so many other people. I met, you know, one person who, look, you know, I don't know if I have cancer or if I don't. I can't get the diagnostic testing that I need. The doctor says, you need to get these tests. I can't afford it. Don't have insurance. You know, low-wage worker, struggling to make ends meet, struggling to pay the bills, can't seem to get the test. And look, you know, we're talking expensive tests. This stuff is not cheap. Which is why you do need to have that health security. And I've said this before, and I know it's a little tiresome after a while, but the reality is look, folks, without health security, you've got nothing. Without the ability to fend off illness, without the ability to pay for, I look at myself, and you know, my wife and I, we do fairly well. We're not lighting the world on fire. We're not rubbing elbows with the Rockefellers, but we're okay. Fortunately, we're not in the half of the nation that's a paycheck or two or three away from being in poverty, fortunately. And again, I attribute that to the fact that for the vast majority of my working life, I worked under a pretty good collective bargaining agreement. That for the work that I did and the hard work and the backbreaking work and the manual labor that I did, it was well compensated. And I did. I made smart choices. I did smart things with the money. And I'm okay. One major illness could send me into trouble like anybody in this country. And when I look at this report from the Corporation for Economic Development that points out that almost half of the nation are living on the edge of financial collapse, and that they have almost no savings to fall back on if they lose a job or get sick or some other income-depleting emergency pops up. They found that, you know, look, we're liquid asset poor. The report is called the 2013 Assets and Opportunities Scorecard, and it says, look, you know, at the end of the day, we lack the assets, the adequate savings to cover basic needs, to keep us above the federal poverty line if something happens. And, you know, the number they used was just 3 months. I was told as a kid, you got to have 6 months in the bank. 6 months living expenses in case something happens. Now, this came from, you know, my grandparents who were Depression-era folks who understood what long-term trouble was. And fortunately, they instilled in me that you've got to have a safety net to fall back on, a cushion to fall back on. And I've been fortunate that I've been able to do this. But over the summer, I had that gallbladder thing. I had no idea what it was. Absolutely, positively no idea what was going on. My producer, he didn't know what was going on either because I'm lying on the floor of the studio writhing in pain. I'm literally rolling on the floor of the studio. Unable, and I have never been in so much pain in my life. And for me to voluntarily go to the hospital, in fact, go out of my way to go to the hospital, was pretty monumental. And, you know, my wife was scared to death. But without insurance, I can't imagine what 3 weeks in the hospital, plus a surgery, would have done to our savings, would have done to our financial stability. I guarantee you, I know what it would have done. It would have dropped us right out of anywhere near the middle class and right there, like this report, under the poverty line. And then what? Well, then my kids have problems. And then my wife has to go to work. And then we have a whole bunch of things that are really very negative. And I don't want that for anybody. Health security should be one of the very first things. You know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, you know, life is first. Pretty simple stuff, I think. And I think we need to be thinking in terms of that. Life security should be a fundamental right. And the sad reality is a lot of people that I've talked to, a lot of the folks that I know who may be the underinsured or the folks who have the high deductible plans and are hoping and praying that they don't get sick, they would deny someone else any measure of coverage just because it's those people, the others. And I've heard so many people talk about, well, you know, those immigrants are coming to take it up and they're abusing our healthcare system. What does that say about us? What does it say about us to the rest of the world? I mean, it's mind-blowing to me that we spend twice as much as everybody else, and yet we don't insure 50 million people, that we have 100 million underinsured. Sounds like rationing to me. But yet, for all of the talk from the folks on the right, you would think that the death panels, and I've said it before, if there are death panels, I want to be on it, because there are some people I'd like to see gone. It's kind of mean, isn't it? Probably pretty wrong, which is the other reason we don't have death panels. Oh, no, wait a minute. We actually do. The insurance companies who have been able to deny care time and time again. The insurance companies who were able to go back into your past and kick you off a plan retroactively because maybe you forgot to put something down on a form, but they found that you took an acne drug back when you were a teenager. Something called rescission. They were able to do that in the past, and because of this, they're never going to be able to do that again. And yet, those are the days our friends in the GOP want to take us back to. And I just wish, and I said this yesterday, I just wish all of the anger, all of the votes to repeal, all of the court challenges and the legal wrangling and the rallies and the emails and the direct mail and the bus trips and all of the effort that's gone into denying people the basic fundamental right to life, I wish they would use that energy to making sure that each and every person enjoyed that fundamental right and that we made sure that we had the best. I know a lot of people thump their chest and wave their fingers saying, we're number one. I wish we really, honestly, and truly were number one. And for what we spend for health care, we should already be number one. For me, it's about allocating the resources that we're already spending in a much smarter way. I'm going to take a quick break. Back here in Washington, D.C. for the Healthcare Summit, the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. We'll talk.
America better. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
I'm told that many Americans long to return to the idyllic days of yesteryear, to the small-town wholesomeness of the 1950s, when everyone valued freedom, truth, church, community, baseball, and Walt Disney. Never mind that such a fantastic time and place didn't actually exist. The important thing is that there is someone today, a unique visionary, who plans to build just such a utopia for all who yearn to have a life of harmony and happiness. Glenn Beck. Yes, the walking... fucking ego of the far, far, far out right. Beck has built his lucrative career on fostering fear, disparaging whole segments of our society, promoting plutocratic elitism, and spreading divisive lies and conspiracy theories. But lately, he's been humming Kumbaya and offering himself as the recreator and guru of the elusive yesteryear. In early January, he revealed that his dream is to build a place that is some hybrid of a small town, a theme park, an entrepreneurial incubator, a re-education center to instill right-wing truth in young people, and, in his words, a retreat from the world. He wants to call it Independence, USA. It will have everything, a residential area where rich and poor will live as neighbors, a marketplace with real businesses and stores, a media center for himself and others, including a school, quote, where aspiring journalists would learn to be great reporters, a ranch where residents will grow food and where visitors can learn how to farm, a theme park, possibly based on Ayn Rand's creators versus moochers dichotomy, and a church that, oddly, would be, quote, modeled after the Alamo. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a place! Of course, the downside to living in Glenn's dream world is that he'd be there, too. That'd definitely spoil the perfection.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light, hey, stand up for your rights, come on, get up, stand up.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. We are here in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I think this is the sixth year I think we've been to D.C. for this conference. And every year I come and every year I learn something new, and which is why we come here, which is why I think these things are so important. And the reason we come is to bring the information back to you so that we have the most informed, educated, and, of course, activated listeners on the airwaves. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website, therickssmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So the guy who was against choice in healthcare, the guy who's against you being able to choose whether you're going to have health care and be able to afford the health care and where it is, the guy who's not going to set up the exchange, who fought against you getting health care, he now thinks we should be expanding because we need consumer choice. At least that's the hashtag that they're using, consumer choice, to tell us we need to hock off our state wine and spirit shops, that we need to hock off of what I consider an extremely valuable asset. Something that we own, that we're shareholders in, that they just want to give away. Why? Because they don't want to raise taxes on the wealthy. And like we talked about yesterday, you look at the tax burden on residents of the Commonwealth, completely upside down and backwards, where the folks at the very bottom pay the highest percentage of their income in taxes, and the people at the very, very top pay the lowest income as a percentage of their income. And you go, you know, there's something seriously wrong, something fundamentally wrong with that. And, you know, we just came off an election cycle where taxes were I think that was the real issue of the entire thing. You had Mitt Romney running around saying, well, the 47% pay no federal pay. He wanted you to believe they pay no taxes. It's no federal taxes. But that's income taxes only, and we've been through this, but you know, people still pay the federal withholding taxes. But you look at the state level, very regressive taxes across the board. And, you know, this, to me, this selling off of our asset, this wine and spirit shop, is going to come with a lot of societal costs. It's going to come with a lot of oversight, a lot of regulation, a lot of, well, out-of-pocket stuff that we're going to have to pay. And they seem to think that, well, you know, we'll just, you know, we'll tax them. Because Terzai made a point of saying, well, you know, of course we'll tax them. But who's going to pay for all the additional enforcement? Because they said they're going to have to hire more policemen. They're going to have to hire more auditors. They're going to have to hire more people who are going to oversee it, to regulate it, when we've already got that in place. I mean, I agree with Senator Scarnati. We should be modernizing it. If you want to have alcohol in the stores, let's figure out how to do that. We the people, we do it for ourselves. This way we still maintain the control to make sure that my kids don't get a hold of it, that your kids don't get a hold of it, and that it's accessible, but it's accessible in an adult fashion. And I've said it before, look, I know where liquor is. If I want a bottle of Jack, I want a bottle of whatever, I know exactly where to go to get it. I want a six-pack of beer, I want a case of beer, I know exactly where to get it. And I listened to some of the representatives who said, well, you know, someone would come into my district and they wouldn't know to go buy beer. Now we're going to make it easy for them. Yeah, by having it everywhere. I think it's insane. Absolutely insane. So, you know, yesterday we talked about it. The day before they rolled it out, well, yesterday what happens? The big story yesterday, well, at least this is the report from WPVI Action News 6. Evidently, the son-in-law of Governor Tom Corbett is under criminal investigation. This is according to their report. Philadelphia police announced an officer has been placed on administrative leave. Investigation's going to happen. Sources told Action News that the officer is Corbett's son-in-law, a guy named Gerald Gibson, who works for the narcotics division of the police department. Interestingly enough, Corbett's daughter works as a narcotics prosecutor in the state's attorney general's office. And you go, hold on, wait a second. Is there something called nepotism? Something, there's an N-word. Yeah. I wonder how that works out. But it's kind of interesting. And I guess the son-in-law got caught with some marked bills. You know, they had a drug sting. And what they do is they mark the bills. They mark down the numbers because you want to be able to trace it. Because as I'm sure everyone knows, every bill, every dollar, every piece of paper money that we have has a number attached to it. And in fact, $20 bills and above have RFID chips in them, so they can track them pretty well. You can see them. It's pretty simple stuff. Well, he got busted with, or allegedly got busted with some marked bills. And that's kind of troublesome. And, you know, I look at this and I go, really? We're going to hire more son-in-laws to oversee the wine and spirit shop? We're going to hire more son-in-laws to... Oh, man. You know, it just doesn't... I guess it's karma. It just doesn't get any more surreal. But it doesn't surprise me. Because these are the people who do believe that the law doesn't apply to them. These are the people who believe that the rules don't apply. And I guess that they know better, that they know best. And for me, I go back to all of this privatization. I go back to all of this opening up of vices. I mean, what's next? Are we going to? And I know a lot of people, and I've had more conversations with people who say, well, we'd like to bet on sports more than we'd like more lottery. So are we going to open up sports gambling in the Commonwealth? Because I think that would bring in more money than more scratch-off tickets. What do you think? I'll be honest. I might throw down 20 or 30 bucks on a football game every now and again if it were easy and accessible and legal and helped the seniors, because that seems to be the only way we're willing to help our seniors is by spending. And I've made this argument before. Look, yeah, what does it say about us that, you know, education, because the governor has linked the privatization of the wine and spirit shops to education, something Senator Scarnati just the day before said he didn't think was a good idea, thought it was actually a bad idea to be linking things together at this point of the budget process. And I understand, you know, you were talking about a flatlining of education spending because, well, we need liquor dollars. I mean, what does that say about our interest in the future? We're going to use hard tax dollars to give tax breaks to huge corporations, but investing in the future of our children, that's not that important, and we're going to hope that someone decides they're going to go out and get blasted and pay for it? Oh, I know. We're going to do the same thing with liquor that they're going to do with lottery tickets. We're just going to get more people doing it, right? Because if you put the liquor there near the Tic Tacs, you put it there at the impulse aisle next to the National Enquirer, people are going to buy more. But of course, that makes perfect sense, and it's not going to cause any problems. And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, when I was a kid, and this is just going back, you know, 30 years ago, we used to be able to drive into, you know, like your drive-in beer distributor, and they would hand you a can of cold beer. We're going to go back to those days. Now they're going to hand you a six-pack. You're good luck. Good luck in your trip. And there's part of me that goes, that's what they want. They want to be able to make all of that resource, all of that money off of the disaster that's going to come out of it. Because these are the people who truly, firmly believe in disaster capitalism. The more crisis, the more disaster, the more degradation, the more they think they can pull off, the more of this that they can perpetrate on the consumers and the working people of this country, the better it is for the bottom line, the more profit they can get. If we can get people smoking and drinking and gambling and doing all that stuff, hey, maybe they're going to have a heart attack and we can benefit off it with health care. Or that seems to be the way things are looking. And the more I look around and the more I see this messaging, and I listen to his press conference, and it just blew my mind. Who's doing their polling? And as I'm watching his press conference, I'm going, the Democrats are going to be against him. As much as you want to think that the Democrats are going to be pro-privatization, they're not. It's the Republicans he's losing. Because there are a lot of very socially conservative Republicans in the state Senate who are going to go, whoa, whoa, whoa. I got some good God-fearing church people in my neighborhood. They don't want drinking and carousing and gambling and all of that stuff. They're happy with the way things are. You put those vices over there. We don't want to mainstream the vices. We don't want it in our face all the time. And that's what I'm hoping is going to happen. And I think that's what's going to happen. Because what you're seeing is the people who are calling themselves conservative, they're not really conservatives as we've known historically. You know, the Eisenhower conservative is long gone in the Republican Party. The social conservative, there's still a tinge left. What we see mostly are the corporate conservatives, the ones who believe in anything for the bottom line. Vice spending for the bottom line, you betcha. And look, that's what they're basing our economy on. Think about what this governor has done. Stop for a second. Think about this. He's rolled out the lottery privatization. He's rolled out the privatization of the liquor stores. I think education privatization will probably come next. And then maybe we'll talk about a transportation bill. Now, I understand it's going to be in his State of the State speech next week. And, you know, I'm waiting to see what's in with that. How much of a pound of flesh are workers going to have to give back? How much are we going to lose to get a transportation bill? Will it be tied to funding for the pensions? Of course it's going to. Zogby already told you. They're going to tie that pension obligation to everything. Because we need to give more tax breaks. We need more handouts for the very wealthy. And, of course, more vice spending for you and me. I mean, it just blows my mind. And I don't know how long it's going to take me to get over. I sat in on that hearing I shouldn't even say it was a hearing. It was more of a dog and pony show. It was more of a scripted, choreographed draft where even the Democrats were saying, oh, I'm sorry, I don't mean to ask a real question. I know I promised I wouldn't. But what struck me was the company, the UK company that came and said, look, we pay out 50% of every dollar that we bring in prize money, while here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, they pay out 61 to 63%. So I'm expecting that to drop down. So players get prepared to lose a little bit. But more importantly to me was what the vice spending went for in the UK and cultural heritage, societal advancement, the Olympics, for instance, that's where the money goes. Not for vital programs that help the most beloved, the most needy, the most vulnerable. I'm sorry, I just don't see, the good in saying we're going to fund our programs for our seniors in some states, in like Ohio, education through vice spending. You wanna spend vice spending on something? Maybe the vice spending should be going to the tax breaks. Maybe if you workers, if you gamble enough, maybe we'll give some back. Kind of like we're doing with the state income tax for a couple of companies in the Commonwealth. I don't know that we know who those companies are, but they get to keep your state income tax. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice of us to work for them and then pay the companies? I think it is. Anyway, got to take a quick break. Right back here in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Again, if you missed any portion of the Rick Smith Show, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back after this. Stick around.
This Valentine's Day, give your special someone a beautiful Swarovski crystal heart made by women who have survived war in South Sudan. These stunning items are available in small, medium, and large sizes and come in crystal, red, pink, and other beautiful colors. And the best part? They're yours starting at just $25 plus shipping. To order yours today, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop.
Earth, sky.
In late 2012, a planet was found in the Alpha Centauri star system, only 4.3 light years from Earth.
It's the nearest extrasolar planet found yet, but getting there would be hard. If you imagine Earth as a grain of sand, then Alpha Centauri would be over 10 kilometers, or about 6 miles, away.
So how could we get to Alpha Centauri? A vehicle like the space shuttle couldn't do it. If Earth were the size of a sand grain, the shuttle's orbit would be about the width of a hair, in contrast to the 10 kilometers to Alpha Centauri.
How about the two Voyager spacecraft, launched in 1977? They're now heading out of the solar system. They're not aimed towards Alpha Centauri, but if they were, it would take tens of thousands of years to get there. Meanwhile, other propulsion systems, for example, antimatter engines and solar sails, haven't advanced far enough for star travel.
And here's the real problem with traveling to Alpha Centauri. Suppose we chose a method of travel and set out for a trip among the stars. Suppose that, generations from now, our descendants arrived at a planet in the Alpha Centauri system. They might be greeted by a brass band and crowds of Earthlings who left later but traveled by a more efficient process, and so made the trip in a shorter time. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the word Starship. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So more gun news, more fun in guns, if you will. You saw the other day in Seattle, a missile launcher showed up during a gun buyback. Same thing happened in Los Angeles. And you go, why can't we have these little toys? Why not? I also looked at, Gun Appreciation Day was not too long ago, and in the week that followed, you had 6 or 7 incidents where people got shot at gun shows. And you go, I got to be honest, there was part of me that always said, that's how we thin the herd. The guy who looks in the little hole and pulls the trigger doesn't reproduce. The sad thing is they have, because I guess we've gotten much better at taking care of them. This guy, the last guy, a couple of days ago, was showing off a 25 caliber pistol and thought it was unloaded. I just thought it was unloaded. I didn't realize that when I pointed it at my hand and pulled the trigger that something would go bang and come out and shoot a hole through my hand. And there's part of me that goes, should we cover that? I mean, if he shows up at the hospital and goes, I shot myself, should insurance have to pay for that? I mean, because it kind of was premeditated. I wonder, maybe I'm going to ask somebody that today when we're talking to the folks here about Obamacare. Should Obamacare pay for stupidity when people shoot themselves? I remember, when I first moved to Pennsylvania, it was one of those days, National Hunting Day in PA, right after the Monday after Thanksgiving. I showed up to work, one of the few people who did that day. And I remember a couple of people had And it was almost like a rite of passage. I remember somebody said, you know, they were climbing over a fence and, you know, tripped and fell and they shot themselves in the leg. And everyone was like, oh, that's horrible. I'm going, that's stupid. But, you know, I guess it is what it is. We are the gun culture. And thanks to Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, he has pointed out the fact that austerity, the austerity brought on by his party, is going, you know, understand, we've lost, what, 700,000 cops and firefighters and teachers and public sector workers over the last couple of years. He's admitted, he's going, look, you know, at the end of this, because of the fiscal state that the country's in, the choices that they have made, understand, all of this stuff is done because they have chosen to do it. All of these hostage crises, all of these, this debt, this is their choosing. But they're saying, according to Lindsey Graham, because of the fiscal state that they've put us in, well, there's just going to have to be less police officers. There's going to be less, not more. And he said over the next decade, you know, it's going to go on. So you're going to have less response time. It's going to take longer for police to get there. And he went into this whole story about the woman in Georgia who shot the guy 5 times. Well, what if she needed that 14th or 13th bullet or whatever number he came up with? And you go, we can fix those problems. It's the choices that they make that puts us in this situation. And you look at, you know, thinking of that in mind, this idea that somehow we're going to be arming children. And you look at Missouri, for instance. They've got a bill in their legislature that's going to require all first graders in the state to take an NRA-sponsored gun class. And you go, wait a second, do I want the NRA in my first grader's head? Hell no. Do I want them to be responsible around guns? Sure, I want them to know if there's a gun there, they don't pick it up, and they don't look in the little hole and pull the trigger, something that obviously the guy at the gun show didn't understand. But I guess it is part of our gun culture, especially when you look at this story from North Dakota. The West Fargo Hockey Association, you know, I played hockey as a kid for a number of years. And I always remember, you know, fundraisers, because you had to do it. Everyone needed to raise money. Well, they decided, well, wouldn't it be nice if we raffled off 200 guns? And we raffled off 3 of these AR-15 military-style assault rifles. Wouldn't it be a great idea? Wouldn't we make money? And guess what? Overwhelmingly, it's extraordinarily popular. According to their website, due to the overwhelming response to this raffle, we are not taking ticket orders at this time. Until we're able to validate the remaining ticket count, because they want to sell 4,000. They're going to sell 4,000 tickets, hoping to make about $90,000. And there's part of me that goes, you know what? I got to do a gun raffle. Because the NRA, again, another one of these front groups, much like the Chicken Council. What's amazing to me is the sheep mentality, the herd mentality. So the Chicken Council says there's going to be a shortage. Everybody runs out and they buy. And guess what happens? The price goes up. So at the beginning of the Obama term, the NRA and their gun fronts say, you know, Obama's going to tax your bullets. And the price of bullets are going to go up. So everybody runs out and they buy bullets. And again, that whole supply and demand thing plays into effect. And what do you have? You have the price of bullets rising. Self-fulfilling prophecy? Obama had nothing to do with it. Was nowhere near it. Didn't mention the word. But good PR, good spin, and you now have this situation. You have this situation where the self-fulfilling prophecy. And I look at this situation in North Dakota. And I guess the question becomes, is this something that we should be raffling off? And I struggle with it. Because I do believe you should have the right. A responsible gun owner should have the right to keep and bear firearms in their homes. And, you know, if you want that responsibility to carry it around, I think it is a responsibility. I don't think it's something that we should be raffling off of the local hockey association or something that has an entire arena full of of people walking around pulling triggers. It's not surprising to me that you have these. And to be honest, there's part of me that goes, I'm surprised we don't have more. But here's the thing that I want to end with on this. Because it's one of those moments where you go, even the gun people identify the fact that guns are dangerous. You look at all of the gun shows that say, please come, but leave your loaded guns at home. Please don't bring your guns because it's unsafe. You look at the RNC who had the little convention, wouldn't let the faithful. Now, these are the people who are the most staunch advocates of people carrying guns and arming children and arming teachers and janitors and the crossing guards and bus drivers and all of this. And you couldn't bring it into the convention. And you look at all of this news, and I ask the question, is it more guns that we need? Do we need easier access? Do we need to have more? I tend to think no. But there have been an awful lot of sad news here recently around guns. And I don't know if it's just because it's in the news and we're hypersensitive to it, or if it's just happening more often. Or is it that thing that happens where it's in the news, so you have people who, I want to be in the news. Very bizarre situation we've got. But at the end of it, again, this to me is another one of these special interest groups of the NRA imposing their political will, imposing their financial will, and the rest of us kind of just following along. Going to take a quick break back here from the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, D.C. And again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at therickssmithshow.com or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Right back.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This Valentine's Day, give your special someone a beautiful Swarovski crystal heart made by women who have survived war in South Sudan. These stunning items are available in small, medium, and large sizes and come in crystal, red, pink, and other beautiful colors. And the best part? They're yours starting at just $25 plus shipping. To order yours today, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya gun workers, good news to you out there. Oh, how the brutal union has come in here to clear. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. We are here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. here in Washington, D.C., talking about the Affordable Care Act and the implementation and all of the obstacles and all of the opportunities that I see coming in the next several months. The question is, you know, how do we get those who are underserved or not served at all to have coverage? How do we make sure that everyone, regardless of whatever condition, whatever segment they are in, get the care that they need? I'm sitting here with Kellen Baker. He's a policy analyst over at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. Kellen, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much, Rick. Glad to be here.
You know, your area of expertise is in the LGBT Research and Communications Project over there at American Progress. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing.
I work on a variety of policy issues, which sounds really boring, but trying to work on improving the circumstances in which gay and transgender people and their families live their lives. And one of the key elements or factors, if you will, that structures how well gay and transgender people are able to live their lives is health. So we focus in this project at the Center for American Progress, we focus on LGBT health from a variety of perspectives. And one of those, obviously, that's in the news so often these days is the implementation of the health reform law.
So as we're looking at the implementation and the marketplace of, you know, different policies that are going to be available, what's being tailored or what's being done to address the concerns of folks in the LGBT community?
There are a wide variety of challenges that LGBT people experience and that result in LGBT people, us, having lower access to health insurance coverage, being less likely to get the health care that we need, and as a result, being sicker.
I would assume it would be, you know, you're talking about high-risk pools and being in the high-risk category, correct?
Not necessarily. There's a perception that HIV and AIDS is restricted to the LGBT community, and that's not actually true. The fastest-growing segment of the epidemic is among young African-American women. But the disproportionate burden of the HIV/AIDS epidemic still does affect gay and bisexual men, particularly men of color and transgender women. So there is a significant degree to which focusing on HIV/AIDS prevention, testing, and services is an incredibly important part of LGBT health overall. There is, though, this other aspect of LGBT health, which is the degree to which we're just like everybody else.
Right.
LGBT people live in every corner of this country, and we're experiencing the same economic concerns, the same health concerns, the same struggles that anybody is. And then you add in the additional burden of discrimination, of being told that you and your partner can't get married, of being bullied at school, of being harassed in the workplace, because contrary to what folks think, there is actually no federal law that protects gay or transgender people from employment discrimination.
Sure, we talked to a guy who in our area was the first guy fired from his employer back, you know, years ago for, you know, simply just his choices at home.
Right. Last hired, first fired.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, is a reality for a lot of LGBT people still across the country. And that has a direct impact on health, not only because we know that discrimination makes it harder for you to be healthy, it also impacts your access to health insurance coverage, because most people in this country get health insurance coverage in two ways, either their employer or their spouse's employer. And if you're experiencing employment discrimination, you can't get a job, or the job you can get is low wage, doesn't offer benefits, then you can't get access to coverage through that road. The other road, your spouse's employer, most states...
But you can't get married, so... You know,
most states, you can't get married.
How are you going to get...
Exactly. And so that means that LGBT people, particularly people living in same-sex relationships, are unable to get that very tool, insurance, that makes healthcare in this country affordable.
See, I have a very libertarian view on same-sex marriage. I could care less. I mean, it's none of my business. You live inside your four walls. I live inside of mine. But my theory on it has always been, I think we should extend the right to be miserable to everyone. And you talk to a lot of married people who, you know, why not? I mean, and until, you know, I love this argument that we need to protect the institution, especially when you're talking about a 50% divorce rate. I think we're doing a pretty bad job of protecting that institution on our own.
Right. Let the gays get married. You know, let the numbers go up of how many happy couples are living together for the long term. And I don't see how that doesn't help us as individual communities, as families, and as a country.
As my grandfather always said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself.
Exactly.
And I wish we would do a little bit more of that. But bringing this back to the healthcare discussion, because there are some issues that are specific towards the LBG community, and you know, every community has specific needs and wants. How much do you see that in the Affordable Care Act being specifically tailored to make sure that people get testing, and not just people in the LBG community, but everybody? What do you see in this?
The Affordable Care Act, as the law itself, is really just a collection of cliff notes. It's really sort of the highlights, the top-line items. There's so much that's being fleshed out right now by the Department of Health and Human Services, and a lot of that is focusing specifically on those major, major issues that LGBT people experience, but that also, as we've discussed, so many other families, so many other people across the country are experiencing. The lack of access to insurance coverage, the lack of access to affordable care, the lack of access to preventive care that keeps us from getting sick in the first place. So the Affordable Care Act has a lot of different components that are working on addressing these various issues. One of the centerpieces of the law is the expansion of affordable insurance coverage. And there are two ways that that is going to happen. There's private insurance coverage, which starting in 2014, every state, even Texas, even Pennsylvania, no matter where you are, will have a health insurance marketplace where people will be able to go online, compare plans, and get subsidies to make the cost of coverage affordable. And that is estimated that about 20 million people, including many LGBT people, are going to be able to access affordable insurance coverage through the health insurance marketplaces. The second way is through the expansion of the Medicaid program. And this is something that governors across the country are deciding now, whether their states will expand the Medicaid program as required under the Affordable Care Act. And that would really be a huge loss for LGBT people and for so many people if states choose not to expand their Medicaid programs.
Yeah, mostly low-wage working people.
Exactly, because the law provides that the Medicaid programs should cover every individual who makes less than $15,000 a year. That's a lot of our people. That's a lot of low-wage workers. That's a lot of gay people. That's a lot of transgender people. That's a lot of folks with kids, with families. And making sure that they have access to the protections and the benefits that the Medicaid program offers is a major opportunity in the law.
What do you say to those who, you know, because you know, I sit in this room and I hear a lot of people talking about, well, this, you know, this community, or where we've already segmented ourselves. And one of my big complaints about what the working people of this country allow to happen is we divide ourselves. You're African American, you're LGBT, you're Hispanic, you're this, you're that. We're all in this together. I mean, my view is we're all working people. We're all fighting for the same thing. We want to make sure our kids are covered. We want to make sure that we're covered, our spouses, all of this. So there's part of me that goes, why do we allow ourselves to be divided up into these subcategories?
That is definitely one of the big principles that we keep coming back to in our work at the Center for American Progress, is that we are stronger together, that it's not about who's gay or who's transgender or who's African American or who's a woman or who's an immigrant. It's all of us who are fighting for the opportunity to live the lives that we want, to take care of our families, and to contribute to our communities. And that is something I think that gets forgotten a lot in the media representations in particular of the gay population or the LGBT population. There's this stereotype that everyone is white, male, wealthy, lives in San Francisco, doesn't need any help, has no problems.
I think you pointed out, I mean, it's not just an LGBT issue. I mean, African-American
exactly.
women, you said, are the fastest growing population. I mean, it's in everyone. So the research and the things that need to be done, you know, it's for everyone.
It is. And gay people are African-American, and gay people are immigrants, and transgender people have the same variety, the same diversity of backgrounds as anyone else. So this whole idea that we're all in these different groups and there's no intersection between us is just wrong. There are so many people who live at the intersections, and the health reform effort is one big opportunity to move things forward
and
for
bring
all
us together. Kellen, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Thanks so much, Rick. It was a pleasure.
Kellen Baker, health policy analyst with the LGBT Research and Communications Project at the American Progress. Quick break. Right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
At the Families USA Health Conference in Washington, D.C., Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin told Workers Independent News that she believes President Obama is truly committed to a progressive agenda.
I think he's very serious about it and very much a president who, with the election behind him, is looking toward addressing real problems that we have in our country. We'll shortly hear the details of his propositions when he makes his State of the Union address, and I expect to hear continuation of the same themes that we saw at the inaugural.
Senator Baldwin supports worker rights to collectively bargain, and she says the rights taken from Wisconsin public workers should be restored.
The power to come together to speak collectively is incredibly important, and obviously in Wisconsin we've seen workers attacked for exercising just that basic right. I truly believe it needs to be restored, but we have a lot of battles to fight along those lines, including a recent lower court case questioning the actions of the Labor Relations Board.
As far as Senator Baldwin is concerned, cuts to Social Security and Medicare are off the fiscal negotiation table in Washington.
With regard to Medicare and Social Security, you know, when people have worked hard their whole lives, part of the dream of the middle class is to have a secure retirement. These should be off the table, I believe, in our discussions moving forward.
On gun control, Baldwin says she supports the Second Amendment but wants to see common sense changes to gun laws, including greater use of background checks for gun buyers. And she says the political dynamic really does seem to have changed and shifted in favor of comprehensive immigration reform.
I was very encouraged to see four Democratic senators and four Republican senators come out with an agreed-upon set of principles for comprehensive immigration reform. Now, this was not a bill. This was a set of principles. But I think that shows a recognition both that we need to do this because it's long overdue, but also a political understanding that the parties need to work together to get this done. So I'm very encouraged that we'll be able to make sincere and significant progress.
Senator Baldwin was the keynote speaker at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. We're here in D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. I'm sitting here with Ron Pollack, the founding executive director of Families USA, the people who put this conference on. Ron, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
I appreciate you extending the offer. We've been here, and I 6 years now. We've been to this radio row, and every year we learn a little bit more. Every year, I get a little deeper into the issue.
So we look forward for the next 30 years to have you here.
The hope is that, you know, in 30 years we look at, and I think, you know, John Kennedy said about Medicare, you know, in 30 years we'll be going, how'd we ever live without it? There's part of me that I'm hoping that when my kids get a little bit older, they look back and go, how did they ever live without this?
Well, there's no question. This potentially is a sea change. You know, for literally a century, we've been trying to get serious health care reform in the country that would make sure that everyone has access to affordable care. And, you know, dating back to Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, you can keep on going on. But Barack Obama and got the Affordable Care Act passed. And Now we got to implement it.
Yep.
You know, it's one thing to pass a piece of legislation and have it on a piece of paper. Now we got to make sure that people get the benefit of it. And I have to say, the overwhelming majority of people who will benefit enormously from it do not yet have an inkling as to how it will affect their lives. So that's a big task that's ahead of for all of us.
Yeah, I was talking to someone a little earlier, and they said, you know, the majority of people who would benefit from this don't even know it really exists or that it's coming. And I find that extremely hard to believe when you look at all of the messaging and all of the fight, especially on the right, who have Supreme Court challenges with 35 repeal votes on the floor, even a new repeal vote here or a new repeal bill here. I find it hard to believe that people don't know it's coming.
Well, they know that there's something there, that, you know, and, you know, but there's been such a contentious debate. There's been a lot of mythology that's been thrown out. And so it's been a political debate. But what we need now is for people to understand personally how it's going to affect them and their families. And that is what is not known. You know, the national surveys of the people who are shut out of the healthcare system today, who don't have healthcare coverage, who now can go get coverage in these new marketplaces and get subsidies, significant subsidies that will make coverage affordable, they don't have an inkling about this. And so the tens of millions of people who stand to gain enormously from it, they just don't yet know. And so that's
an education
job.
Process. Now, 30 years you've been doing this, I understand, you know, to get to this point, now you got 30 years more to make it a sea change, a part of our culture.
Well, you know, in eight months, we actually start the process of enrollment. In October 1, we start the process of enrollment. In 11 months, people who enroll actually are going to get the benefits. So our hope is we get this work done as soon as possible so that as soon as this new set of benefits becomes available to people, they know about it and they get enrolled.
Yeah, I heard someone, I was talking to someone in the hall who said, you know, their concern was is as soon as we do, as you say, in October 1, we're going to start enrolling people, January 1st, people get the benefits. The concern is that there's going to be a flood, and you're going to overwhelm the system that we have. And I said, you know, that's probably a pretty good thing to have, people going to the doctor, a little preventative care, I think, not a bad thing.
No, I hope we have high tide rather than low tide. You know, there's so many people who are shut out of the system today. If all these folks learn about it and enroll, they will get enrolled, you know. But I'm more afraid that a lot of people are not going to feel that, you know, that
they
there's something in this legislation. You know, they've had such bad experiences with health insurance. They've been priced out of coverage. They've many have pre-existing conditions, and we're told by insurers they can't get coverage. There's all this fine print that nobody understands. So people have had some bad experiences with the insurance system, and we've got to make sure that they understand there's a new day coming.
Yeah, but isn't that a problem of continuing the private model? I mean, there's part of me that says, you know, part of my complaint with how they're setting this up is we're still stuck in the private model, where we're going to have all these choices, and I'm still waiting to see them rolled out, and I want to see what the choices are. But my fear is that they're complicated, and folks, like you say, they just throw their hands up and they walk away.
Well, I think that this whole system is designed in such a way that when people learn about it, it'll be a whole lot easier for people to get enrolled than they've ever had before. But, you know, the Affordable Care Act is not the last word on health care reform. It's a platform. It's a floor. It's a foundation upon which we're going to build. You know, when the Social Security Act passed in 1935, over half the women in the workforce were excluded from Social Security benefits. Over two-thirds of the people of color in the workforce were excluded from Social Security. And obviously those things got fixed. Now, the Affordable Care Act is a huge leap forward. It's a historic measure. But it's not the final word. It's not perfect. And we're going to improve, we're going to improve it. And so kinds of things you're concerned about, we will work on.
Yeah, I mean, because there's part of me that wishes that, you know, all of the attempts to repeal, all of the attempts to stall and delay and poison pill the Health Care Act, I'm hoping those people who will take that energy and improve it. I mean, because you stop and you think about all the energy that they've put into denying people coverage. What if we use that energy in a more positive direction?
Absolutely. That's going to be a critical step for us to be taking in the years ahead. And but right now, job one is make sure everybody understands that they can get help. So people, there'll be these new marketplaces. People can select from a private insurance plan. And for a family of four, if they have income less than $92,000, or family of three, if they have income less than $75,000, they're going to get subsidies. They're going to be in the form of tax credits that will be paid that will make sure that the premiums people are supposed to pay are considerably less.
And we make it affordable that everyone can do it.
That's right. And so we've got to make sure people learn about that.
And where do we go to do that?
Well, you certainly, in terms of background information, immediately people can come to our website, www.familiesusa.org, familiesusa.org. But in the months ahead, in every state, there are going to be marketplaces that are going to provide information to people. And that's ultimately where people are going to go so that they can figure out what plan makes most sense for them and their families.
So in coming out of this conference, the number one thing that you're preaching here in the conference and going out is getting this thing rolled out and looking at how we're going to make sure that people find out about it.
It's converting from a good law to reality on the ground, so that families actually experience this benefit and wind up being able to afford coverage for the first time.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to, for the millions, some 50 million people uninsured, the 100 million underinsured that we have in this country. I think this is a step in the right direction, as you've pointed out.
Absolutely.
Ron Pollack, I appreciate the time. Thank you for inviting us. We always enjoy our time here. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for being here. Hope to see you next year.
Already founding executive director of Families USA. We've got a link to the website at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Ron Pollack's name. Quick break. Right back with The Rick Smith Show here in Washington, D.C. Stick around.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
I'm told that many Americans long to return to the idyllic days of yesteryear, to the small-town wholesomeness of the 1950s, when everyone valued freedom, truth, church, community, baseball, and Walt Disney. Never mind that such a fantastic time and place didn't actually exist. The important thing is that there is someone today, a unique visionary, who plans to build just such a utopia for all who yearn to have a life of harmony and happiness. Glenn Beck. Yes, the walking, talking ego of the far, far, far out right. Beck has built his lucrative career on fostering fear, disparaging whole segments of our society, promoting plutocratic elitism, and spreading divisive lies and conspiracy theories. But lately, he's been humming Kumbaya and offering himself as the recreator and guru of the elusive yesteryear. In early January, he revealed that his dream is to build a place that is some hybrid of a small town, a theme park, an entrepreneurial incubator, a re-education center to instill right-wing truth in young people, and, in his words, a retreat from the world. He wants to call it Independence, USA. It will have everything. A residential area where rich and poor will live as neighbors. A marketplace with real businesses and stores. A media center for himself and others, including a school, quote, where aspiring journalists would learn to be great reporters. A ranch where residents will grow food and where visitors can learn how to farm. A theme park, possibly based on Ayn Rand's creators versus moochers dichotomy. And a church that, oddly, would be, quote, modeled after the Alamo. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a place! Of course, the downside to living in Glenn's dream world is that he'd be there, too. That'd definitely spoil the perfection.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
We need a budget that employs simple honesty for the common growth of our Commonwealth. We must continue the journey that will turn the road to recovery into the path to prosperity.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website for ricksmithshow.com. So we're going to be funding education with liquor money. We're going to be funding senior programs with lottery money. How are we going to fund the Medicaid expansion? I was thinking about it. When the governor gives his speech next week, there's some question. Will he have some money in the budget for the Medicaid expansion? I have the perfect thing. We could sell off drug treatment centers, maybe to his son-in-law. Because he's got some cash, some marked bills, but, you know, hey, use the narcotics money to fund Medicaid expansion. Why not? You know, hey, I like the liquor, I like the lottery. We might just be the vice state. Heck with the name Pennsylvania, we're the vice state. Simple stuff. Anyway, I've got Antoinette Cross, project director with the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, sitting here in front of me in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Here to talk to us about how Pennsylvania is going to fare in all this. Antoinette, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having us.
So our governor, fortunately, in my view, has decided that they're not going to set up the exchange, or I guess now it's a marketplace. Maybe you can explain the difference. He's not going to do it, so we're going to let the feds do it. Even though big Republican, big 10th Amendment guy, going to cede control to the feds, does that make any sense?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, he really gave the ability for Pennsylvanians to be innovators of healthcare and handed it right back to the federal government, despite what everyone in the Commonwealth wanted, from advocates to even insurance industry folks.
But I'm okay with him going, we'll let the feds do it, because I think we would get a much better plan that way.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, you know, Pennsylvania families, individuals, small businesses will have access to healthcare, and it doesn't matter, you know, that the state does it or the federal government does it.
Now, the big question is you know, the expansion of Medicaid. I don't expect any positive things out of his State of the State speech next week. I expect more division, more selling off of state assets, more liquor economy. And I guess maybe if we're all liquored up, we won't know what he's saying. But, you know, what happens if we don't expand the Medicaid?
You know, we're leaving billions of dollars in federal money on the table that we could draw down for Pennsylvania. So, you know, it's paid for 100% for the first 2 years and 90% match rate after that. So we would walk away and money would go to other states. You know, Governor Corbett at this point is just really playing politics in what's a common sense issue.
Oh, surprise. I love the Penn State thing. I'll file a lawsuit months after I agreed and was one of the people who pushed for it purely out of political opportunism.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, it's not only economic, but we would leave about 500,000 individuals in our state without health insurance. And these are working individuals making between $8 and $16 an hour.
Oh, silly. You think he cares?
Yeah. I mean,
what was his first act as governor?
He ended health insurance for working adults by cutting adult basic.
There you go. 41,000 people he kicked right in the behind, right to the curb. So why does he care about the rest of them? And maybe I'm being too simplistic, and maybe I'm not giving him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe there was a good reason. I've yet to find it, but maybe there is one.
Well, at this point, it's purely economics, and the money is clearly there. I mean, it's $38 billion that would come into our Commonwealth over about 10 years. So there's money on the table. So if he walks away from it, it's purely political reasons.
Yeah, you know, I keep hearing all of these reasons. We need to privatize the liquor stores because we need to have education money. We need to privatize the lottery because seniors need money. All of this stuff. I'm looking at this money that we could be getting from the feds with the expansion of Medicaid, and I go, there are jobs that could be created. And you know what those jobs that we create could do? Could fund education, could fund senior programs, so we don't have to hock off our liquor store and our lottery and have a vice-based economy. Kind of seems actually rational.
Yeah, I mean, by taking the money, we would obviously create thousands of jobs in our state. On the flip side, hospitals are going to be losing money, and they were expecting to have money from the Medicaid expansion, so it could actually have the opposite effect and start killing jobs, you know, in the healthcare industry.
You know, we've heard a lot of, while I've been here for the last 2 days, I've heard a lot about the implementation, how this is all going to roll out. And I know the exchanges have now been changed to a marketplace. I'm sure purely a PR move because we want people to think that this is still free market, even though it's purely a private-based system. Even though I keep hearing my Republican friends say, government's taking over health care. October 1st, I guess, is the enrollment period. What are you guys at Pennsylvania Health Access doing to get this started up, get people the ability to enroll? What are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, we're gearing up our efforts to really let people know that this is coming and that they'll qualify and they'll get tax credits to help them get coverage. We're talking about, you know, 75% of the population we heard here has no idea that October 1st they'll have access to all of these new health insurance programs. So we're out in the streets. We're educating folks that this is on its way.
Now, you're one of the groups, and I give you guys really a lot of credit because you're on the ground actually talking to very real people. I remember talking to a number of folks when the governor kicked the folks off of Adult Basic that we were able to secure through your group. And, you know, what are the folks saying now that you're out there knocking on doors, you're out there talking to people? What are their anticipations? What are their hopes? What are their thoughts on this?
Well, so one of the interesting things is we still talk to those folks that Governor Corbett kicked off Adult Basic. We have a woman that works two jobs, can't afford health coverage, and she's looking forward to be able to get coverage under, you know, the new Medicaid program. But if Governor Corbett doesn't accept the money, she's once again going to be shut out of the system. So, you know, these folks are looking forward to it. Let's hope we can get them coverage.
Yeah, I mean, it just blows my mind. And I look at all the effort, and I look at all of the work that the right has put into to fighting this back, and I look at all the money that the Commonwealth has spent in being one of the lead plaintiffs in the case against it. And I go, you know, haven't you just taken that kind of initiative and that kind of that vigor and that kind of initiative into actually getting people coverage? We'd be done with this by now. We'd be so far down the road.
Right, and I think no one saw this coming, but we're still seeing, you know.
No one saw this coming? No
big
one saw
industry
this?
Funneling, like, thousands of dollars into our state to kind of make sure that some of these protections don't happen.
And why is that? I mean, you would think that, because I've seen some reports lately about these hospital associations going, we want the Medicaid money. This is how we're going to survive.
Yeah, the hospitals are on board, and what folks don't realize is that part of the Affordable Care Act, you kind of end charity care programs for people that don't have insurance because the idea is hospitals would be reimbursed by Medicaid dollars. So they're out in full force trying to convince Governor Corbett to make this happen. But, you know, we're going into election year. The Tea Party's in Pennsylvania, so.
Well, if I could correct you, the Tea Party money is in Pennsylvania.
Right.
I mean, you know, one of these AstroTurf groups. And I think most of the people, or at least all of the people that I knew who at the beginning were like me, were angry and were taking to the streets, they've since fallen to the wayside. Because they look at where the Tea Party has gone, they go, too extreme, too radical, too, not my interest.
Right, and I think a key indication of where Governor Corbett's taking his signals from was in the announcement of not doing a state-based exchange. A right-wing kind of lobby group put out a statement before Governor Corbett released his statement to the press. So how did they get that if that's not who
It's not that they got
to?
It. It's they what they it told him.
Right.
And that's what he was supposed to do.
Correct.
So as we go towards the October 1st beginning date, what should we be doing? What should folks be doing to prepare for this? How do we make sure that this rolls out fairly smoothly.
You know, if you're an individual that makes up to $42,000 a year and you don't have health insurance, you're going to get tax credits to help you get health insurance. So, you know, talk to your friends and family who don't have health insurance and tell them this is coming.
And I'm a big fan of screaming at legislators, especially Republicans who are the ones who are against this.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be out in full force over the next 6 months really pounding the pavement to make Pennsylvania accept this federal money to get the rest of folks covered.
Well, I look forward to talking to you in the future as this unrolls. I'm looking forward to talking to people who have gone through the process, so I look forward to the future.
All right, thank you.
Antoinette Cross, I appreciate the time. Project Director of the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Quick break, right back after this.
In late 2012, a planet was found in the Alpha Centauri star system, only 4.3 light years from Earth.
It's the nearest extrasolar planet found yet, but getting there would be hard. If you imagine Earth as a grain of sand, then Alpha Centauri would be over 10 kilometers, or about 6 miles, away.
So how could we get to Alpha Centauri? A vehicle like the space shuttle couldn't do it. If Earth were the size of a sand grain, the shuttle's orbit would be about the width of a hair, in contrast to the 10 kilometers to Alpha Centauri.
How about the two Voyager spacecraft, launched in 1977? They're now heading out of the solar system. They're not aimed towards Alpha Centauri, but if they were, it would take tens of thousands of years to get there. Meanwhile, other propulsion systems, for example, antimatter engines and solar sails, haven't advanced far enough for star travel.
And here's the real problem with traveling to Alpha Centauri. Suppose we chose a method of travel and set out for a trip among the stars. Suppose that, generations from now, our descendants arrived at a planet in the Alpha Centauri system. They might be greeted by a brass band and crowds of Earthlings who left later but traveled by a more efficient process, and so made the trip in a shorter time. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the word Starship. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Be back in 2016. Absolutely. Education, commerce, and he forgot liquor. Got to get rid of the liquor stores. Wait a minute. That's our governor. Never mind. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So I saw the big headline this morning. Big headline, schools might need liquor privatization. I'm going, really? Is that how we're going to fund the most precious asset our state has? Is that how we're going to fund the future of our state? With liquor sales? And I guess, you know, when you look at it this way and you go, we're funding our senior programs with lottery? Yeah, why not? You know, and I think I like the idea. I think I'm kind of on board with the idea of health insurance. We're going to fund that through, you know, through drug money. You know, maybe we'll get Corbett's kid to take over. We can sell it to him. Maybe he's got a freezer full of marked bills we can use to fund health care in our state. But it is choice week. Our governor wants us to believe that it's super choice week. We can have choice for liquor, choice for lottery, choice for gambling, and now choice for schools. And I've been saying for a while this whole choice thing, it's all about destroying public education, which they're doing quite well. But we don't want to have choice in voting. And I saw this story this morning. Again, you know, I live in Cumberland County where, you know, the Republicans control the county commissioner's office 2-1, and most votes go down 2-1, and this one was no different. Evidently, they've decided that they're going to move one of the polling places from Shippensburg University to a local fire hall. And, you know, to me, it really reeks of voter suppression. It really reeks of, hey, we're going to put another roadblock in the way for college kids and for the younger generation to vote. And I think they're being quite honest about it. I look at Commissioner Gary Eichelberger, one of the more far to the extreme Republicans, who said that people who want to keep the polling place at the school, they're, in fact, trying to manipulate votes. Think about this for a second. Because we want to take the polling place away from where it's easily accessible for college students who overwhelmingly seem to vote for Democratic candidates because, you know, Democrats seem to – it's purely a policy thing. Understand that, you know, the Republicans keep wanting to push this free market, you're on your own nonsense, where student loan debt has skyrocketed under their view. You want to take that vote not away, just make it a little more difficult, move it somewhere else. You know, so where those kids who generally don't drive, don't have cars, they would have to find transportation over to the fire hall. And, you know, it seems like a good win-win situation for the Republicans, right? I don't get why we would be doing this. But I know why. And I look at House Bill 94, and this whole voting thing to me just one of those situations where we should be screaming in the streets, another issue. And as I've been saying for the longest time, this is part of that no rights at work agenda I talk about. You know, not only taking away your ability to earn a decent living with health care and with retirement, but also selling off state assets, education, making education harder to attain, and also, you know, your right to that ballot box a little more difficult to get to, your right to the franchise a little more difficult. And, you know, this House Bill 94 to me, one of those things that blatant attempt to steal and rig the 2016 election. And it's going on around the country. I mean, there are other states. In fact, Virginia, I think, was one of them that just pushed back, said, no, we're not going to do it. I saw Michigan. The governor of Michigan said he plans. He said he didn't think it was the right time. He said, you know, it kind of backs off of it. Said, I don't think this is the time, which made me go, uh-oh, here it comes. Because the last time he said now is not the right time, it's divisive. It was about the right to work legislation, which he quickly made sure was part of the law. And it just leaves me scratching my head. You know, the people who talk to us about good government, that, you know, they're going to keep things in line, that they're going to be open and transparent. You look at the things that they've done and the things that they're getting away with. It's angering and it's frustrating because we get news stories with the headlines of education might need liquor. The argument that they're making for moving the polling place is evidently the university wanted a small donation. I think $100. They're going to save $100. Come on. We know better. Just leaves me scratching my head. And, you know, and it's really all about suppressing those at the bottom. This whole opposition to healthcare reform was really about those folks at the bottom. And you go back to the election. You go back to Mitt Romney's comments about the 47%. That is full force right in our face. And I look at the guy who's the attorney general in Virginia, Ken Cicinelli, who I guess is going to be the nominee for their 2013 gubernatorial race. He's going to be the Republican there. Came out with a book And again, it comes down to one of the questions that I keep asking people, you know, this Medicaid expansion. The view that has been put out, the view that the right wing keeps hammering on is, well, this is for those people, those poor people. And Cincinnati is saying kind of the same thing in his book. He says, you know, one of their favorite ways, meaning Democrats, to increase their power is by creating programs that dispense subsidized government benefits, you know, like Medicare and Social Security and, you know, outright welfare, you know, like those food stamps and help paying your rent and the light bill and help paying to keep heat on, you know, those handouts. And he goes, you know, citizens will vote for those politicians who promise more benefits each year rather than the fiscally responsible politicians. You know, the fiscally responsible politicians like our governor, who has cut $2 billion from education, kicked all those people off of adult basic and all those kids off of CHIP. You know, they're responsible. Responsible. You know, I don't know how you can make the argument that's even remotely close to responsible. But the argument that the Attorney General there in Virginia is making, creating government dependency, he writes, is the typical method of operating for big government status. And you go, look at what the private sector has done. And I'm as much of a private sector supporter as anyone where they should be. I want them making tennis shoes and shirts and cars and all of that as well. I don't want government doing that. But I think something as vital, something as important as healthcare, something as important to my life, liberty, as healthcare, I don't think should be left to the private profiteers. Because we've seen what they've done with it. You know, we heard a lot about rationing during the discussion on healthcare. And I go, you know, we've already rationed care. You know, those 50 million people who don't get it, those 100 million people who are underinsured, that's rationing, my friends. But at the end of the day, this whole frame of the 47% has, in the right-wing circles, has stuck. And who are those 47%? Well, those are the low-wage workers. Those are the people who don't make enough to pay federal taxes. Those are the people who want to, but they're not making enough. And I look at this story before we take a quick break. I look at this story that I saw at the Consumerist a couple of days ago. Evidently, a woman who was a waitress at a Applebee's went on Reddit and put up a receipt that one of her you know, her customers left, and it was a receipt for their dinner. I guess there were like 20 people in this party, and as you know, a lot of restaurants, if you have parties more than 8 or 9 or whatever it is, they add an automatic 18%. Gratuity on top of your bill. It's automatic because, you know, look, the reality is, you know, you get some people who, they leave nothing. So this is a way of making sure that for large parties, because it's a lot of work, that the waitress or the waiter, they get compensated. And while I'm against the idea personally of the 18% gratuity, because I tip much higher than that, it angers me that others don't. So, and this is where this has come from. But anyway, she posts this receipt on Reddit that is kind of hysterical because they added the 18% gratuity, which amounted to about $6.29. This person scratched it out and put a big zero. And in underneath it wrote that, well, he gives 10%. To God. He said, I give God 10%. Why do you get 18? So you get zero out of it. And this woman put it up and she said, look, you know, I thought it was comical. It was not to be, you know, wasn't for any other, it would be entertaining. She said, you know, I thought the note was insulting, but it was comical. She said, I posted it because I thought other users would be entertained by it. Well, this woman who's working for tips, one of the 47%, one of the people who would probably benefit from this health care law, she was fired from her job because she posted this receipt on social media. Because the good reverend, or so he said, said that he gives 10% to God. Why should you get 18%? We sure allow these folks to get away with a lot of insanity in the name of God, don't we? Quick break, right back from the Families USA Healthcare Conference. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. That's all.
Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555. Or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Is America truly the land of the free when working families have to struggle to survive? Are workers free to achieve the American dream?
The Teamsters Union is North America's strongest union. We fight for our 1.4 million members and all of America's working families. Teamsters are fighting for the rights of the middle class in Washington, in state capitals, in city councils, and most important, in the workplace. Join us in the fight to keep the American dream alive.
Connect with the Teamsters Union at Teamster.org, Facebook, and Twitter.
But the fact
Vice
is,
President Cheney, though, said it's not a Ponzi scheme. You say it is.
If Vice President Cheney or anyone else says that the program that we have in place today and young people who are paying into that expect that program to be sound and for them to receive benefits when they reach retirement age, that is just a lie. And I don't care what anyone says. We know that. The American people know that. But more importantly, those 25 and 30-year-olds know that.
He doesn't care what anyone says. He knows. You know, again, it goes back to that blind faith belief. It's the ideology that they've been fed. You know, and I've heard it so often from the right that, you know, the younger generation is going to see a UFO before they see a Social Security check. And look, it's a nice little talking point. It's nonsensical, but it's mastering message. I mean, you got to give the Frank Luntzes of the world the credit that they deserve, linguistic experts that they are. But here again, in the fact world, they're wrong. I'm sitting here with Max Rickman, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Max, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for inviting me.
When you hear that, you know, because I saw you make a little face, because you've heard that so often, that the next generation is going to see a UFO before they see a Social Security check. What pops in your head?
Well, I just know there have been a lot more Social Security beneficiaries who have gotten their benefits every month on time, in full, a lot more of those folks than have seen UFOs. So I think it's typical of the myths that have been spread over time, effectively, to discourage especially younger people from supporting the program. And it's our challenge to counter those myths with a hard dose of reality.
Yep.
And one of the things that I think younger people need to know is the facts about Social Security solvency. It's the trustees issue a report every spring. Last spring, 2034, everybody will get every penny they're entitled to in 2034. And with some common sense, gradual changes, a program can be extended well beyond that. But equally as important, in my opinion, for younger people to understand, is Social Security is there for them right now. 30% of Social Security benefits go to non-retired workers, survivors, spouses, disabled, children. 3 million children get by because of Social Security being there.
I was one of them.
Well, you know then, if a parent dies young or becomes disabled, that program is there for minor children. So, as an example, and you're probably a better example, if you are a 27-year-old worker with a spouse and two children, you have right now about $500,000 worth of combined life and disability insurance because Social Security is there. Now, a lot of people, younger people, don't even know about that and don't find out until something bad happens and someone will say, well, you know, Social Security, you should go see the Social Security office and you may be able to get some assistance. So I try to explain it by, I ask people at our town hall meetings, how many of you have heard the term FICA? Well, everybody knows what FICA, but how many know what it stands for? It's Federal Insurance Contribution Act. It's insurance for programs. The acronym is OASDI, Old Age Survivor and Disability Program. So once you kind of get your head around the concept of this is insurance against disability, against death, for retirement security, I think you have a better appreciation for it. But yes, you're right. A lot of money has been spent to spread and perpetuate the myths like the UFO one you talked about.
Yeah.
And we've got to do our part now. And you're doing yours.
And you brought up 2034. Every penny paid to 2034. The day after 2034, everything doesn't stop.
Absolutely not.
Because I keep hearing, well, they're going to go bankrupt after that. No. Will it go bankrupt? Will
Absolutely
everything
not.
Cease to exist?
For that to happen, you'd have to have 100% unemployment. If that were the case, then there'd be no money.
We've got bigger problems than that.
Yeah, we've got bigger problems than that. We're
well,
through.
It's like interstate. You know, the governor is pushing this privatization of the pensions and, you know, trying to change the pension formula, saying we got a $41 billion unfunded mandate. And you go, yeah, if everyone retired at this very moment, this second, and nothing changed in the future, it's nonsense.
It's nonsense. This in 2034, the program, with no changes whatsoever in benefits, revenue, it will pay about 77% of what it should be paying for another 30 or 40 years. So that's the gap that needs to be addressed. Is that a crisis today? No. Did we need to make dramatic cuts to Social Security as part of the fiscal cliff because of that gap that happens in 22 years? No. Every time there have been some changes to the program, the most dramatic ones were in about 30 years ago, in the part of the result of what was called the Greenspan Commission. Those changes were made for the sake of the program, not to bail out other parts of the government, but for the sake of extending the program. And it's a good thing we did,
right?
Because we planned. I wasn't working on it then, but those that were planned for the introduction of the baby boomers into a retirement community, and money was stored, saved in the Social Security Trust Fund, and that has helped us. Will help us get through that balloon in the population of beneficiaries. But what I would hope is that there would be some serious effort to look at how we can bring more revenue into the program in the future. You know, a lot of people don't know that there's a cap on the amount of wages that you are subject to the payroll tax, to that FICA tax.
Yep.
And if you make above this year, it's $113,000 a year, you don't pay anymore. So if you're making $113,000 a year or $113 million a year, you pay the same. And that needs to be addressed.
I'm with you, and I've always said we should do, and I think it would be a major stimulus. You raise that cap, you just take it off, and you lower the rate.
You could do that. There are a lot of ways to look at it. You could politically, maybe it's easier to start it again at 250 or 300 or some, you know, I'm just talking about the politics of it. You could have the percentage be different for those under the 113,000. You could have a different percentage. Now it's the same, equally divided, employer employee. You could adjust that. There are ways it can be done that I think bring more fairness into the program and more revenue. And you address if you lifted the cap all together, as you just mentioned, you wouldn't have a solvency issue.
It'd be flush with resource. But to bring this back to the healthcare, since we're here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference, to bring this back, I look at the rollout of Social Security, I look at the rollout of Medicare, and I go back to the JFK quote where he was saying, you know, when they were talking about Medicare, hopefully in the next generation, in 30 years, they'll look back and go, how did we ever live without this? And I look at my grandparents' generation, who my grandmother now is looking back and going, you know, how did her parents live without it? And, you know, some of the lessons I was hoping you'd be able to fill us in on during the rollout of Social Security, during the rollout of Medicare, what were the bumps? What were the arguments against it? And are we seeing the same ones today?
Well, I remember reading about the Social Security rollout, and you know, there was a lot of opposition to Social Security and to Franklin, President Roosevelt's efforts to have a Social Security program, and a lot of employers would put in early pay slips. This is the message they put in a note. The message was basically, this is how much money the government is stealing from you, in effect. And there was an effort to discourage public support, and there were efforts to repeal it, just as we saw with the Medicare Obamacare, that has some dramatic improvements. And at this conference, some of that is being discussed. Improvements in Medicare. And if you believed so much of, I'll call it garbage, in the political campaign the last couple of cycles, 2010 and 2012, you would think that health care reform or Obamacare devastated seniors. It's just the opposite.
$716 billion
exactly.
Of stealing.
Right. That didn't come out of seniors' pockets. Seniors, bottom line is, under Obamacare, a Medicare beneficiary gets more in terms of benefits and is paying less for their Medicare. Now, how is that hurting a beneficiary of Medicare? The money that was saved came out of reimbursement rates to providers, most of which they agreed to as part of the negotiations. And the Health Care Affordable Care Act, for the first time ever, seniors get all this preventive care with no out-of-pocket costs. You know, diabetes testing, mammograms, colonoscopies. They get the donut hole, that infamous donut hole, will be closed entirely over the next few years. And that's good for seniors. You don't have to pay this big out-of-pocket cost for prescription drugs under the Affordable Care Act in a couple of years. And the solvency of the Medicare program was extended by 8 years. In my book, those are good changes. But just as originally with Social Security, people that didn't like it try to roll it back, repeal it. But it's what you just said that is so important. The more experience people have with these programs, the more they appreciate them, and they don't want them taken away and the benefits cut. And the same thing is happening with the Affordable Care Act. The last few years, when people realize, hey, this is good. I mean, all that stuff about cutting Medicare,
death panels and
death
rationing. And
yes, that's not happening. In fact, I'm getting more. Better benefits, improved benefits. I'm paying less than I would have otherwise in my premiums. It's a pretty good deal, and it will be harder. I don't think you'll see too many more repeal efforts. You might see a few of them this year.
Well, there was the first bill. The very first bill introduced was Michelle Bachmann, and I'm glad they picked the craziest
member.
She's in
a category of her own, of course, but I think you won't see the kind of momentum. I mean, the last Congress, I think they had 30-some votes to repeal it. And obviously it was political because it wasn't going to happen. And I think the reality is the support for repealing it is going to dissipate very soon.
That's the way I see it. I see it as we move down the process. There's going to be some bumps. There's going to be some problems. There's going to be some glitches, but we'll work through it, and hopefully we put the same effort into fixing the problems that the Republicans have put into trying to deny it from us. Max, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
It's good talking to you. Thanks for inviting me again.
Thanks so much. Max Rickman, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Quick break right back after this from the Families USA Healthcare Conference here in Washington, D.C. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Goodbye. Yeah. You're looking for experience. You're looking for someone with a proven track record. With the climate change about man-made global warming in this country. And everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem. I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science of man-made global warming was not climate science, it was political science.
My only friend, the end of our
kind of now, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Wrapping things up here from the Families USA Healthcare Conference. You know, I go back, and my thought on this is, you know, I got a lot of problems with the laws of this. But it is the base, it is the beginning, it is where it's not the end. It's the beginning of this journey. And I go back and you look at today in labor history. The bricklayers were one of the first groups of workers to work an eight-hour day. They fought for years to have an eight-hour day. It was 1867. And on this day also, in 1913, about 25,000 silk workers in Paterson, New Jersey, they went on strike for that eight-hour day. And you look to today. We think that today it just is. Like it has always been. Our view is that, you know, it's always been. We've always had this. And can't imagine what it would be without it. Now, there's some destruction of it, but look, you know, I know my generation at least looks at it, it is what it is. And I look at this healthcare law in that same vein. It's going to be a fight. The passage, that wasn't the end of it. That was really just the beginning. The hard part now begins. The hard part of implementing it. The hard part of fixing all of the glitches, all of the things that are going to come up. And look, you know, there are still lawsuits out there that could undermine this whole thing, especially when you start talking about the money that they're going to need to pay for it. And my fear had always been that the Republicans would find a way, that the naysayers and the folks who don't want to expand health care to everyone, they were going to find a way to defund it. So you would have this great law. You would have this right, but no money to do it. And I look at this and I go, you know, I want what Kennedy said. And you go back to the 60s when they were talking about Medicare. And he said, you know what, in 30 years, you know, they're going to look back and go, how did we ever live without this? And I want my kids and their kids and that the next generation to look back and go, you know, it's a right. How did they ever think otherwise? How did they ever think differently? Because it works. It benefits us. There are no more people going bankrupt because of illness. There are no more people losing their lives because they couldn't afford preventative care or follow-up care. It just seems right to me. Anyway, if you missed any portion of our broadcast the last 2 days here at the Families USA Healthcare Conference, go to thericksmithshow.com where we have all of our programs archived there for your convenience, there for your enjoyment, entertainment. If you have any questions, any comments, anything's popped up in your mind during the past 2 days of us being here, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been
been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color and light, tide and flood beneath the lunar sway, imperial, mysterious, and